be here with us. I know we had a short timeline of pulling this workshop together, so I want to recognize each and every one of you who are so passionate about mental health, and thank you for making this a priority. I want to thank the members of the Duval delegation who are here with us today. As each of us has seen over the last year, there's a growing need for our community and for our state to address the needs of the mentally ill. According to Florida State Mental Health Agency, the Department of Children and Family Services, the following facts underscore the scope of the challenge and the issues involved. I ask you to consider the following. Florida reported over 152,000 adults who received two or more mental health services last year. There were 10,748 reported to be living in homeless shelters. There were 44,007 reported to be living alone and independently. 47,947 reported living independent with a relative. Of those adults who received at least two mental health services, 34,069 reported going to a crisis stabilization unit. According to the Department of Corrections, there were 17,168 in Florida prisons that reported a mental illness. That represents 17% of the state prison population. There's been a 153% increase in the percentage of the mentally ill in our jails from 1996 to present. But while we often look at problems like this through the numbers, I think it's also important that we understand the very personal and real effect that it has on Floridians. And so I ask you to remember the story that was reported in the Florida Times Union in October of last year. And it reported, the Florida Times Union reported that Henry Hereford was charged with the murder of his mother, 59-year-old Jeanette Hereford. He had been arrested 7 times for trespassing and had been Baker-acted 17 times. This senseless death, by all accounts, stemmed largely from Henry refusing to take his medication and the associated psychotic symptoms that resulted. So as we go through the workshop today, I want you to remember this mother that perhaps many of us have never met, but she paid a very terrible price. And so as we look for solutions, we must look for how these ideas perhaps could have prevented her death. I know many of us worked on the sex offender laws last year, but I will tell you that we have more work to do in that area as well. If a person with a serious mental illness commits a sex offense and is determined to be not guilty by reason of insanity or incompetent to proceed, they never appear on the sex offender registry. Clearly, our community and our state is faced with a serious crisis in how we meet the needs of the adults with mental illness. It is my goal today to focus on several questions. Number one, how should Florida law be changed to prevent the senseless death of people like Jeanette Hereford? Number two, what factors are contributing to the growing use of jails, prisons, and homeless shelters to house and treat the mentally ill? Number three, what change needs to be made in how we organize and deliver mental health services to reduce the need for crisis-driven intervention? And finally, what law should be changed to help ensure that those mentally ill who enter the criminal justice system receive the care, treatment, housing, and supervision they need to ensure that they do not pose a threat to others? What additional tools do our courts need to protect people like Jeanette Hereford? And so with that, we will get started. I will first recognize Senator Gibson's aide to make just a brief comment.
Thank you.
Hello and good afternoon. My name is Farisha Hammond, Legislative Assistant to State Senator Audrey Gibson. Senator Gibson is unable to attend the workshop today, but thanks the chair for the focus on the issues surrounding mental health funding. She recognizes that proper attention and purposeful funding in this area is long overdue and looks forward to advocating during budget and policy discussions during continued committee weeks and the legislative session. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And I want to say a personal thank you to Chairman Burden for being here today, especially for the position, the leadership position that you have in the courthouse. I thank you for your time today. I want to recognize Councilman Love. Thank you for being here as well.
I'd like to thank you.
And Representative Jones on cue joining us. Thank you so much. So we have a full agenda today. We have a list of presenters. And we're going to ask first Ben Warner of JCCI. And for those of you who are presenting with PowerPoints, I would ask you to go to the podium so that everybody can get a good look as you're presenting. But first, we'll recognize Ben Warner.
I appreciate that. And I appreciate the number of people who've gathered here together today to talk about this critical issue. We know that mental health is an epidemic sweeping the nation. I was just in California on Tuesday talking about this. We know that we're struggling nationally to deal with this issue. We also know that in Florida we are not doing very well at all. And so I'm very pleased that we're here to address this critical issue. JCCI is a nonprofit organization that was created to bring people together to learn about the community, engage in problem solving, and then act to make positive change. And you'll be happy to know we receive no taxpayer dollars to do that, but are supported by a number of wonderful individuals and corporations who believe in the work of bringing the people together to try to figure out what to do with our most pressing issues and needs. We began this last year, an 8-month inquiry into what to do about mental health in Northeast Florida. We had a group of hundreds of volunteers who met weekly, and this initiative was chaired by Michelle Vaughn of the United Way of Northeast Florida, and thank you, Michelle, for being here. And this group of people, of providers of mental health services, of families affected by the issue, of individuals affected by the issue, a number of people coming together, wrestled with this topic and came out with a report that was released last fall that identified specific recommendations for action. And then we launched an implementation task force with over 100 volunteers who have taken those recommendations and have committed to spending the next 2 years to ensuring that those turn into policy programs and coordination to resolve the issues that we're seeing in our community. And to be able to talk about this, I've invited Pat Hogan, who is chairing our implementation task force, to talk with us a little bit about the most critical issues that they're facing right now. And so if I could invite Pat Hogan to come to the podium.
Thank you, Ben. Madam Chair and members of the delegation. As Ben, I'm going to talk fast because I know my time is limited. As Ben mentioned, several months ago, with a generous contribution from Baptist Health, this community embarked on a mission to study our community's mental health, good, bad, and the ugly. Hundreds of concerned citizens came to meetings. I'm talking about psychiatrists, psychologists, mental health practitioners, community mental health agencies, insurance company reps, hospitals, consumers, family members, and other interested parties. One in four people in Northeast Florida will have a mental illness at some point in their lives. If you have not been directly affected by someone in your family, I feel confident that this issue has touched you in some way. So I stand before you today with good news. We have the plan. This study and the recommendations that followed have given this community a comprehensive look at what we are currently doing and where the gaps are. Now we have over 100 citizens who are giving of their time voluntarily to deal with the many challenges that we face. Today you'll be hearing from many members of our subcommittees. We have over 15 people here that are speaking today that are serving on our subcommittees about strategic planning and legislative agendas, coordination of care issues, professional training and licensure issues, decriminalizing mental illness, managing severe and persistent mental illness, and public awareness and early identification. Over the next 2 years, members of these subcommittees will be carrying out the action plans and engaging the appropriate stakeholders to move forward with the recommendations. One example of this is the Clinton Matters Health Initiative, where Ashley Smith Juarez is leading the charge to convene local hospitals, the Jacksonville System of Care Initiative, and others in forming a coalition to better integrate mental and primary health care. Our mental health crisis is not new. The system has been broken for too long with countless lives adversely affected. I know that the focus today concerns mental health and the criminal justice system. You'll hear from people including, hopefully, Judge Karen Cole, who's been a leading advocate for reform. This is an important topic that deserves your time. However, the mental health issue is complex. It has at its roots the stigma that is attached to mental illness, not only by the society at large, but also by people who have mental illness and self-stigmatize, which often leaves many people untreated. This is a critical issue that we need to talk openly, change attitudes, and assist people who have mental illness to gain treatment to lead productive lives and contribute to our community. Currently, too much money is spent on the back end on crisis stabilization and the revolving door at the jail. We must do better. An ounce of prevention, as you know, is worth a pound of cure. If we rethink how we use our funding, early screening, attracting mental health practitioners to our state, public awareness, and more creative ways to treat people, including telemedicine and embedding mental health practice into primary care settings, we will not only save money in the long run, but most importantly, save lives. I get it. I have a brother right now who's sitting in the Duval County Jail since June. He has a persistent bipolar disorder, and I know that we can do better. The gratifying things that have happened thus far is the result of the community effort to break down silos. The mental health community often felt sequestered to me, but as we sat around the table with one another week after week and continue to do so, barriers are breaking down, self-interest, turf building, and mistrust are dissolving, and now we are speaking with a more unified voice. Thank you, JCCI. You are the heartbeat of this community. My hope is as you go forward, our delegation, with this important and often life-altering work, that you give credence to what this community has asked for, that you use this as a powerful resource, keep an open mind, and work together in the spirit of cooperation. The lives of many Floridians in Northeast Florida are counting on you. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, next members, we'll hear from L. Calicina from Taxwatch.
Good afternoon, everyone. And Chair and Representative, thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to present to you today. As I mentioned before, my name is Ellie Pelsino, and I'm a research analyst with Florida Tax Watch in Tallahassee. Today I'm going to briefly present to you on the revolving door of criminal justice and mental illness and provide some suggestions for improving state policies. To start off, it's important to demonstrate how large this issue is. Between 1996 and 2014, the number of Florida's prison inmates with mild to severe mental illness has increased by 112%, decreasing slightly since 2012, but rising overall from approximately 8,000 inmates to about 17,000 inmates. But when including jails and those coming in and out of the system throughout the year, the total number of people suffering from mental illness who are incarcerated annually in Florida rises to 125,000. In Orange County Jail alone, there are about 1,000 inmates who have some form of mental illness, of which 700 exhibit behaviors serious enough to necessitate psychotropic medication. These numbers are particularly concerning when considering them with respect to recidivism. Florida data indicate that about half of these inmates return to jail or end up in prison. This means that over 60,000 mentally ill offenders will return to the criminal justice system at some point. Assuming about 15% will end up in prison, and about 85% will end up in jail, we're talking about impending costs of about $1.5 billion. Florida's taken steps to try and address this issue. At the arrest stage, police officers go through training to deal with mentally ill suspects, and crisis intervention teams have been developed to deal with calls for offenses or emergencies where mental illness is suspected to be a contributing factor. At the diversion level, Florida has developed mental health courts. These courts are designed to provide targeted treatment for misdemeanor defendants who have been diagnosed with mental illness and whose condition, beyond doubt, contributed to the commission of their crime. During incarceration, the Florida Department of Corrections requires evaluations of inmates upon their admission and has partnered with Wexford Health Sources and Horizon Inc. to provide comprehensive mental health services and treatment for inmates in need. Finally, during reentry, the DOC maintains 61 outpatient substance abuse, mental health, and other treatment contracts across the state that provide services to offenders on community supervision and conditional release. Several other things are also being presented during this legislative session to compound efforts to improve outcomes for mentally ill offenders in Florida through targeted treatment and standardized practices. Of particular significance is state behavioral health care providers' request for $12.5 million in funding to provide jail diversion options and aid in criminal justice reform by providing mentally ill offenders treatment in lieu of jail time. Because though it's wonderful that Florida makes a concerted effort to treat prisoners with psychological disorders, that doesn't change the fact that prisons and jails were never designed to treat the mentally ill. They often exacerbate existing issues and are limited in what they can do as they can't control how long an inmate is detained. So what can we do? Well, as I mentioned before, the majority of mentally ill offenders end up in jail rather than prison. The longest a person can spend in jail is about a year, and the shortest is as long as it takes for them to post bail. So considering over half of these inmates are going to recidivate, at least in part due to their illness, options focused on the treatment of mentally ill offenders instead of their punishment would not only increase public safety through improved outcomes, but also remove a substantial burden on state corrections budgets and on Florida's taxpayers. And we can do this in several ways. First, we can expand mental health courts to include a wider range of mentally ill offenders. Currently, the court accepts mentally ill, developmentally disabled, or brain-injured misdemeanor defendants. Because it was also designed to deal with inmates who cycle through the criminal justice system often due to their illness, the court also accepts defendants with prior convictions, even if some were violent. As long as the defendant is sincere in wishing to participate and is not deemed a significant risk to the public. Expanding this group to allow nonviolent felony offenders with mental illness to be eligible could provide an even greater cost avoidance at minimal risk to public safety. Second, Florida needs to ensure that its assisted outpatient treatment program is used. This program was implemented in 2004 as an amendment to the Baker Act and requires released mentally ill offenders with a history of medication noncompliance to take medication under court order as a condition for living in the community. Yet a decade later, the outpatient provision is rarely used outside of Seminole County, even though it is credited with dramatically reducing hospitalizations and arrests for the mentally ill in Florida, as well as similar programs in North Carolina and New York. And the last and most impactful option to improve state policy regarding mentally ill offenders is to make sure they never enter the system in the first place. The state can do this by providing funding to DCF for substance abuse and mental health prevention programs that target at-risk individuals before they come into contact with the criminal justice system, as well as programs that allow for greater diversion of low-level mentally ill offenders at first contact and match them with treatment. San Antonio and Bexar County, Texas, have taken this latter approach, adding additional components to the crisis intervention model. And today, their jails are under capacity, and they've saved $50 million over the past 5 years. Florida, on the other hand, as I'm sure you've heard, is currently 49th in the nation for mental health funding. And the current funding we do supply for substance abuse and mental health programs hasn't increased in over a decade, even to adjust for inflation or increases in state population. Increased support of substance abuse and mental health programs could help us avoid significant costs in the future. It would cost much less than incarceration in the present. In Florida, diverting or providing court-mandated treatment post-release for just 15% of Florida's mentally ill offenders could allow over 18,000 individuals the opportunity to leave the revolving door of mental illness, crime, and corrections behind. And greater investment in upfront treatment for the mentally ill could allow for even more people to potentially avoid the system altogether. For each one of Florida's mentally ill that doesn't return to the justice system or even enter it, The state avoids an average of $20,000 to $45,000 in corrections expenditures. In this situation, we either make the choice to invest in mental health once or pay for Florida's neglect in the years to come. As Pat Hogan before so succinctly put it, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Finally, I'd like to end with this. In the 1980s, a corrections officer named Kenneth Atkins was assigned to work the mental wing on the fifth floor of Orange County Jail. He's since been off that wing for many years, but to quote the story from the Orlando Sentinel, about 4 years ago, while making rounds on the fifth floor, Atkins came across an inmate he first met when they were both in their 20s. Both were middle-aged now and veterans of the revolving door of mental illness in the criminal justice system. In a rare moment of lucidity, the old inmate looked at Atkins and said, "We're both getting too old for this." Thank you again for all of your attention, and I'd be happy to take some questions and follow up with emails that have listed the articles about what I discussed.
You are recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had a question on the expanding mental courts, allowing for nonviolent felonies and those with nonviolent felony priors. Mm-hmm. Do you know what the impact of that would be in terms of the number of people or the cost associated?
I don't have a direct estimate for you right now, but I can get that to you in the next 24 hours.
That'd be awesome.
Well, I have several questions.
Sure.
You mentioned the mental health courts. Can you give us some information as to where those are operating throughout the state and whether or not those have been codified into state law so that they're being operated in a uniform methodology throughout the state?
It's my understanding that they are relatively uniform. They all accept misdemeanor defendants. They can have violent priors, but they have to be within a certain range. They are implemented across the state, but they're not in every county, which is believed to be an issue.
Okay, but it's my understanding that they've not been codified into state law.
No, not yet.
Okay, so is that something that you think would be helpful in terms of having, you know, if we're looking to expand the number of individuals who would fall within the mental health court system, should we also look at codifying that into state law?
Definitely. I 100% support that idea.
Very good. My second question is, you mentioned, I think the number was 61 contracts that the state has as relates to reentry. Can you elaborate on that a little bit more?
There are 61 contracts that are held, I believe, in a joint relationship with the DOC and possibly DCF. I'd be happy to clarify here. That provide outpatient treatment for sex offenders, for the mentally ill, and for also substance abuse. I'm not sure what else you'd like to say.
Okay, so maybe we can, as we get into some of the other presentations, maybe DOC, you guys can help answer those questions, because I will tell you, it was December 2008 when I went to Union Correctional Institution, which is a long-term prison, lifers, 40 years more, and I'll never forget that day, because the ward pointed to a Redford building, and he said, "This is one of the buildings where we house our mentally ill." And I said, "I want to go in." And I will tell you, I'll never forget that day. It stays with you forever. Clarify something else. I think I heard you say that most of our individuals with mental illness that are in the court system, they're in jail, not in prison. Did I hear that correctly?
That's pretty common. Because many of our mentally ill chair, there's a high rate of homelessness with the mentally ill, so a lot of times they're picked up on the street for public intoxication or other things like that, and they tend to be low-level offenders, so they get sentenced to jail sentences rather than severe sentences in prison.
Okay. And then finally, you mentioned the underused assisted outpatient treatment program, and I think I heard you say that it's really only being used in Seminole County. What barriers do you see as to why it's not being used in the other 66 counties?
That's a really great question, and I can definitely get back to you on that, Chair, but I'd have to...
And so as we begin more discussion among our experts here, we can address these questions. That'd be very helpful. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for
that. Just a quick question.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In addition to the other information, could you let me know how many circuits are presently have separate mental health courts, and if any of those circuits, because of cost or otherwise, have a judge who's part of his or her responsibility is a mental health court? Because I know that in some of these circuits, you know, they don't have as much income, and it's an issue with them. I'd be interested in that as well.
Thank you, Mr. President. I'll definitely get to that point.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Your information is very, very good.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. All right, next we're going to have Dr. Dean Offerhein with the Florida Department of Corrections, Director of Mental Health Services. Thank you so much for being here with
us. Thank you, ma'am. Pronunciation is worth 2 college credits in German. First of all, thank you, Representative Atkins, Representative Bernie, Representative Jones, Councilman Love, and all the distinguished guests and members here in this important forum. You know, they say that the definition of insanity is that when you try something and it doesn't work, you know, just keep redouble your efforts. Or as I've learned in the South, that if you find yourself in a hole and you can't get out, keep digging. I say that with all sincerity because it was almost 15 years ago that I wrote an article called Crisis in Corrections, The Mentally Ill Behind Bars. It was about the alarming growth and the rate of the number of mentally ill individuals in our jails and prisons. Well, it seems like that crisis turned into a way of operating. The crisis never passed. It's still here today. Because we know that Americans with severe mental illness are 3 times more likely to be in a prison or jail than in a mental health facility. That's tragic. We know that 40% of Americans with serious mental illness will have spent some time of their life in a jail or prison. That's obscene. And we know, according to the Bureau of Statistics, that over half, 55% of all state male prisoners, 55% have a mental health problem, which would require mental health treatment, and it's even higher for the females. It's 75%. Have mental health problems which will require attention at some time during their incarceration. So in just 3 decades across the country, the number of mentally ill people in our jails and prisons have tripled from about 6% in 1983 to 15 to 20% today. Now, I think as we've all read in the newspapers or in online, there isn't a day that goes by that you don't read a tragic story about mentally ill individuals being incarcerated in our jails and prisons. That's the national scene. What's happening in Florida? We mirror what's happening in the nation. As we've heard before, whereas our population grew about 57% between 1996 and 2013, the mentally ill population grew 153%. And it is true that about 17% fluctuates to 18% of those individuals in our system have a mental illness, a serious mental illness that requires ongoing mental health treatment. A diagnosed mental disorder which requires ongoing mental health treatment. That means an individualized service plan, a multidisciplinary treatment team, and these officers being responsible to make sure that they're taking out their cells and providing the appropriate care. Now, here's what's interesting. That's 15 to 20%. 1 out of every 7 inmates in the Department of Corrections, nearly 1 out of 7, is receiving psychotropic medication for their diagnosis of mental illness. Nearly 1 out of every 7. But here's what I'd like to bring this home for us. I'd like you to look to the person sitting next to you just for a second, please. And as you're looking at that person, wait till you hear the question I'm going to ask. As you look at that person, imagine that you were an inmate in the prison system. One of you is going to develop symptoms of a mental illness at any given day during incarceration, which will require mental health services. 50%. I can see back here the other person is running this. But I'm going to tell you, the story gets even more tragic as I go on. 17% of those inmates have a diagnosed mental illness that required an individualized treatment plan. When I started back out in this field in 1995, I was in the field looking at charts. I was looking at the medical records. I was looking at the diagnosis, and I would see some severe stuff. Here's what's happened since 1995. Of that 17%, the percentage of those inmates with the most severe types of mental illness, see, 17% of those, the number with the most severe types of mental illness, schizophrenia, psychotic disorders, bipolar disorders, major depressions, has doubled. Went from about 17% of them to one-third. In other words, what we're seeing more and more is long histories of pre-incarceration hospitalizations. We're seeing the most severe people coming in now. So, what does that mean for us? The increase in this population with the most severe types of mental illness, as Representative Ackles was talking about, meant an increase in investment in our most expensive inpatient units. And we had to really try to retrofit prisons, which were ill-equipped, never purposed to be mental health treatment facilities, no doubt about it. So we had to put up the money in there to provide the services. What was the result of that? Well, the number of mental health inpatient beds we have today, which is 1,250, exceeds the total number of involuntary civil commitment beds in the state psychiatric hospital, which I believe is about 1,108. We have more mental health inpatient beds in a prison than the involuntary civil commitment beds in the state psychiatric hospital system. That's tragic. So what's our challenge? The challenge is more mentally ill inmates coming into the prison system means allocation of more resources to provide the constitutionally required care that they have to have. We're required to provide care. If we diagnose it, we identify it, we have to treat it. More inmates require more resources to provide reentry and pre-release planning so that they can be successful in their community reentry. And remember, they have different needs than the non-mentally ill. And more mentally ill inmates means that we're going to have to put more resources into what we call our restrictive housing units, which are the most expensive beds, the most expensive beds we have. Why? Because just like around the country, the mentally ill tend to have more difficulties adjusting to prisons, they get more fights, get more disciplinary reports, and this is everywhere across the country. They have more problems adjusting to the prison environment. And just like in the community, where they have a difficulty navigating the community mental health system, they fall to the cracks, they go to the psychiatric hospital. The same thing happens in the prison system. They have difficulty navigating the open population, they get in trouble, they get into more disciplinary confinement or some other restrictive housing, and guess what happens then? Remember I told you about those 1,250 inpatient beds? Even though the mentally ill in these restrictive housing units, these deep end, high security units, the mentally ill only represent about, probably 1,000 of those people, 1,200. But guess what? They occupy half of all our inpatient beds. Why? They go in there and they get into this cycle, just like in the community. You know, mental health, jail, release, jail, finally go to prison. So what happens is they get in trouble and they go into restrictive housing and they end up on our inpatient bed because they just, it's just, this is never the place for them, for the ones with very serious mental illness. So here's our challenge. We have to provide constitutionally adequate care. There's not a lot of states that have what we have. We developed, when I came on board, we developed a mental health classification system so I could identify those inmates and what their needs were and predict. We give them mental health grades, we send them to institutions with appropriate resources. We've got prisons all over the states. And then we have a continuum of care because I wanted to make sure, absolutely sure, that we meet the community standards for our practices. So they all have a multidisciplinary services team moving through a continuum of care as their mental health symptoms wax and wane, as we all know they will. So they may be an outpatient, they may be an inpatient unit, they may be in a transitional care unit, and we have an involuntary commitment facility, which is just like the psychiatric hospital. where we actually go through judicial proceedings to have them treated, placed and treated involuntarily for a long period of time. And you had asked the request that they give you some quick statistics about the length of sentence. Kind of interesting, the length of sentence for the mentally ill versus the non-mentally ill in our system is not that much difference. It's about 1%. It's 4.41 years compared to 4.46 for the mentally ill offenders. Average length of sentence, same thing, not much difference. About 1%, 3.44 for the mentally ill and 3.39 for the non-mentally ill. So I kind of gave a deluge with a lot of statistics and numbers and facts, but what are we doing about it? We do provide the care. We have to provide the care. I'm passionately committed. I always wonder, how did I get placed in this job? You know, not many of us will like this in health services. Well, what do you want to do when you grow up? You be an astronaut or a fireman? Or, no, I like to work in prison. We find ourselves, and there's a certain calling that we have. And not just mental health and health care, but those officers. And the leadership of Secretary Jones, she's reinforcing that, taking the pride in that calling that we have. Because it's not an easy job. And we have to make sure that we're doing the right thing, but also let's go beyond. So what we did is target initiatives. When it came in 10 years ago, I instituted suicide prevention and self-injury programs. We have inmates that, as Representative Atkins knows, do horrific self-injuries to them. Horrific. From pulling out their intestines to cutting themselves. It's just horrific. So what do? We implemented training and programming. And I can tell you today, according to the Bureau of Justice Statistics again, we have been the leader for the past 10 years in our suicide rates. The national average for state prisons is 16 per 100,000. We have maintained a rate of 8 per 100,000 for the past 10 years. We instituted, as you said before, the crisis intervention team training to assist the officers in de-escalating inmates to avoid unnecessary uses of force. We also created specialized mental health training because I found it is absolutely necessary for these officers to have training for dealing with the inpatient unit inmates. So they get specialized training in not just identifying the signs and symptoms of mental illness, but actively responding to potential signs of deterioration because, again, ladies and gentlemen, mental illness is like any other chronic illness, diabetes, hypertension, whatever. Symptoms will wax and wane according to the stressors, internal and external. So you could be very psychotic at one moment and stable the next moment on your meds. You can't just put a stamp on it and say this is how they are. So we train our officers to watch for those signs and symptoms to wax as they wax and wane. We also developed a web-based inpatient management system. If we have 12,500 inpatient beds, we're sending people every day all over the state to these units. So we're coordinating that better. We also, I thought it was absolutely imperative that we start creating the standard for correctional mental health. We are one of only two programs in the country that have a doctorate psychology internship that is approved by the American Psychological Association. This coming year, or early next year, we will be the first prison system in the United States, including the feds, to have a residency program approved by the American Psychological Association. Why? Because we've got to increase the ability and the skills of our treatment staff. Reentry planning, Senator Wise was in the audience I was talking to, and he initiated this in 2005, right when I came on board. It was the first helping of food I had on my plate. And he said, I want something done about the mentally ill and reentry. We developed the first web-based electronic paperless referral system that interfaces with the Department of Children and Families, makes an appointment electronically with community mental health providers. I want to thank Senator Wise for really supporting that. They ensure that they get the 30 days of supply of psychiatric medication. We also, within 45 days release, we initiate SSI, SSDI applications for eligible inmates. And we also created the first memorandum of agreements with the Veterans Healthcare, the VA, the Veterans Healthcare, to coordinate with their reentry people to assist them in reentry. Now, again, under Secretary Jones, in her leadership, Mental Health Ombudsman, first in the nation. She's supporting it. We're We're actively interviewing. We just had the first round of the interviews yesterday. It is the first mental health ombudsman in a prison system, federal or state, in the nation. It is dedicated strictly to those people who are most vulnerable, the inpatients, those 1,250. When I recommended this last year, I thought to myself, well, we have it for the most vulnerable citizens in our community. We need it for this. And she is fully supportive of that, and we're going to have people in the field proactively identify the mental health ombudsman, the regional ones, and they would report to our central mental health ombudsman. I also work with the American Correctional Association as their national mental health consultant. And last year, I started developing what's called a correctional behavioral health certification with their staff. It will be the first in the nation to provide standardized certification to work with a mentally ill. Lots of different certification. This will be a standardized exam, and we're going to support our officers in obtaining that. It's kind of like the CIT for the community people, but more for the officers. We do CIT. I took the 40 hours, reduced it to 8, so we can focus on the issues which were germane to the prison. So our officers also get CIT. Concluding remarks. This is how I feel. I feel this very deeply. I think we must understand, we're way past bifurcating these issues, that mental illness is a public safety, public health issue. It's really that simple. And that our jails and our prisons do need the resources to provide the necessary care to meet our constitutional requirement to provide that. That's what we must understand. But we must also acknowledge that the cost of the mentally ill returning to prison is greater in the long run than the cost of providing them with adequate care and adequate reentry services. That's what we must acknowledge. And we must work together to protect public safety and provide proper care and supervision for all offenders under our jurisdiction, Department of Corrections, while we assist them in their mental health and reentry. Bottom line, to be successful, we must establish coordinated services, and this is what I'm hearing this is all about, between criminal justice and community systems that are targeted towards the needs of the mentally ill in that system. Thank you very much for the minutes.
Any questions?
Our recidivism rates, by the way, I know you talked about them, over time, they will all be inmates, whether mentally or not. For 3-year recidivism rates, it's held pretty steady. For the non-mentally ill, it's 26%. For the mentally ill, it's 28%. Pretty close. And that's because of this. That's because of that web-based design. But that helps in the beginning. In the long run, you're right. It'll continue. I'm sorry, sir.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate your presentation, and it was very informative, and like you said, a lot of statistics to check. I appreciate actually having that, and would like to be able to maybe get a copy of some of the statistics that you provided. In the corrections process, you were at the end. I mean, you're at the end of the process. The prevention programs are not applicable because they're already there. The people that you have in your corrections are persons that are, it's not a situation where somebody's not guilty by reason of insanity. They have committed a serious felony. They're in your process.
Correct.
They're in corrections. I heard a lot of great initiatives that y'all are doing. However, what my interest is in is in policy, which might make your job easier and ameliorate things at the lower level. So I haven't heard any policy initiatives other than additional resources as it deals with corrections. Do you have any suggestions for us as policy makers and legislators of what we could do at that level, at the level of corrections?
Well, I think very good question, thank you. Not just to make my job easier, I can't respond to that because it you're in the head. First of all, outside, if we put, what do you call them, forensic case manager or something in the community mental health centers, that once the mentally ill inmates get out, to assist them in navigating the system would be great. So behavioral health professionals at community mental health centers that are trained in the criminal justice system that can assist people to continue to work out. Policy stuff, residential treatment, yes, sir. I mean, if there was, besides the mental health ombudsman program, we're going to ask for funding to continue to expand that, but that's the policy issue for proactively identify the concern. But really what we need, I think, is residential treatment units. Right now, the prison system's no different than the public mental system. You have the community mental health system here, outpatient, the deep end here. What about the people that need more secure facilities to help them adapt? They can't, in the prison system, many of these inmates, they can't function in the general population. So if we can have a policy which would help us create and fund residential treatment units, which are in between the general population outpatient and those deep end cost inpatient. So the residential treatment units are like they're protective housing. They get protective housing environment. They get augmented outpatient mental health services. They get reentry planning. It's cheaper, and it's the way to go as far as ensuring that the inmates are kept safe, don't get in trouble, don't fall into cracks. That would be, sir, my major policy issue for the recommendation for the mentally ill in the Department of Corrections.
And just briefly, do we already have some of those in the state of Florida? Are you talking about expansion, what's already there, or are you talking about implementation of something which is new or relatively new?
I probably defer to the people who work in the community about the residential treatment units. I can tell you we did a pilot of one at Union CI, where you visited. And the idea was that when the inmates are in these restrictive housing units and they compensate and go into the inpatient units, when they have to go back there when they're discharged because they're suspended because it was disciplinary or they couldn't operate in the community, it was not disciplinary. And what we did is we created a residential treatment unit where they could work off their time while they're in the inpatient treatment unit. But the 47 beds, of the 47 people so far in a little over a year, 27 of them, I believe, have been discharged from them successfully and never had to go back to close management. So it's stopping them from falling to the cracks, stopping them from getting into trouble and going to the deep end. And we need more residential treatment units for the prison system in general so we can provide that protection they need and the care they need.
So I have a few questions.
Yes, ma'am.
The first is you mentioned 3 days of medications. Did I hear that correct? So when someone with a mental illness is discharged from a prison, they get 3 days of medication.
I'm sorry, 30 days.
30.
30 days of psychiatric medication.
Okay, thank you. That makes me feel my job. 30 days. Okay. Talk to me about, because you mentioned all of the training that you're doing, but I know one of the issues that was discussed with me through the years is the turnover within our correctional officers. Talk to me about how that works. Do you see that as an issue? Are we having to continually provide training because we've got excessive turnover within our prisons?
Yes, ma'am. I don't have the exact numbers. That is a major challenge with the turnover of the officers, especially for this population. You can't just do it annually, do it once, and do it annually because of turnover. So I've been in discussions with our leadership saying, we're going to have to provide periodic training throughout the year for the new staff as soon as they come on to that inpatient unit and in the other high-risk areas. Absolutely necessary.
And then you mentioned the 1,250 beds.
Yes, ma'am.
At any given point in time, what's the average utilization rate for those?
Probably right around max, around 1,000, I think. Pretty close. 1,000 stays pretty steady.
Okay, so 1,000 over 1,250.
For the last couple years.
Okay. And what's the cost, the estimated cost associated with those 1,250 beds?
I'd have to get that information for you. I wouldn't have that available immediately.
Do we have any information that tells us the cost for dealing with an individual with mental health problems compared to an inmate that does not have mental health problems? What's the cost differential?
It varies from state to state. It's higher for the mentally ill.
Is it 50% higher, 10% higher?
Did you have something, Mark? Was caused for the mentally ill?
Not on that.
Not on hand? Okay. I'd have to get the numbers.
I just would be curious what kind of the delta is on that. He could get it out of this?
Yeah, sure.
Oh, just an estimate would be great.
I know, it's more expensive.
Right, but how much? Okay, thank you so much.
You're quite welcome, and thank you again for having us.
And before we move on to our next speaker, I would like to recognize, we have former Speaker Pro Tem Marty Coley in the audience here with us to stand up. Speaker Coley, thank you for being here. Yes, it's good to see you. Next, we will hear from Jamie Carter and Emily Tubbs with the Florida Department of Children and Families.
Good afternoon, and thank you for the opportunity to be here. My name is Emily Tubbs. I am a licensed mental health counselor, and I am with the Department of Children and Families in the Office of Substance Abuse and Mental Health. Today I'll be presenting a broad overview of the BAKER Act, its purpose, and goals. So the purpose of the BAKER Act is to protect the rights of persons who are examined or treated for mental illnesses. It provides stabilization of an immediate crisis and aims to maintain the safety of the individual as well as the public. What does the BAKER Act do? So, BAKER Act provides standards for CSUs, which are crisis stabilization units, as well as SRTs, which are short-term residential treatment facilities. It also protects the rights of persons who are examined and treated for mental illness. And it creates procedures for voluntary admissions, involuntary examination, as well as involuntary placement. The involuntary examination piece of the BAKER Act can be initiated in three different ways. It can be initiated by law enforcement officers, mental health professionals or physicians, or circuit courts. Once the involuntary examination has been initiated, it must be conducted without any unnecessary delay by a physician or a clinical psychologist in a receiving facility. So within a 72-hour examination period time frame, one of three things must happen. The person shall be released unless they are charged with a crime, and if so, they may be returned to law enforcement at that point. If a person is competent, unless they are charged with a crime, they will be given an opportunity to provide informed consent and transfer to voluntary placement, or a petition can be filed with the circuit court for involuntary placement. Just a little bit about involuntary inpatient placement. Involuntary inpatient placement is the BAKER Act's term for civil commitment. It allows for the individual to be admitted for treatment against their consent. And as I said before, the petition must be filed within a 72-hour time period. An individual ordered to involuntary inpatient may receive treatment in either a state mental health treatment facility or a short-term residential treatment facility, or SRT. And involuntary inpatient placement can be ordered for up to 6 months and extended with additional hearings after 6 months. Involuntary outpatient placement, this is a form of commitment that allows individuals to be court-mandated to receive mental health treatment on an outpatient basis. The criteria is more difficult to meet and it's used less frequently, as was mentioned previously, than involuntary inpatient placement. As far as the designation of receiving facilities, Chapter 6585 outlines eligibility criteria and procedures for designation of receiving facilities. The only DCF designated receiving facilities are able to hold a person with a mental illness for assessment. Before a receiving facility can be designated by the Department of Children and Families, they must be first licensed by ACA. And designations are in effect for 3 years and then are renewed at that point. There are both public and private receiving facilities. Both are designated by DCF. The major difference is that public receiving facilities receive legislatively appropriated Baker Act funds, and they must ensure coordination of care regardless of their ability to accept an individual. Also, and I'll provide later a website where all of the receiving facilities are listed, but it's updated frequently on our website because it's kind of constantly changing and evolving as receiving facilities are added. As far as the responsibilities of receiving facilities, they are responsible for providing on-site emergency reception screening and services 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, regardless of an individual's ability to pay for those services. They accept individuals of all ages, and they also should assess individuals for clinical safety, co-occurring disorders, substance abuse disorders, and trauma. And as of December, there were 53 public receiving facilities and 67 private receiving facilities. These are just some Baker Act-related rules. 65E5 covers involuntary examination and placement and rights of individuals, and 65E12 standards for CSUs, SRTs, and standards for integrated CSUs and addictions receiving facilities. These are just some statistics. In calendar 2013, there were 171,744 involuntary exams initiated. That just means that they were initiated. It doesn't necessarily mean a person was admitted to a facility. And the numbers increased a little over 9% from 2012 to 2013. And the most common reason for involuntary exam was harm only. This is a list of some of the Baker Act trainings that are provided by the Department of Children and Families free of cost on our website. And they're currently in the process of being updated by a provider that will be updating all of the different training modules. Here are some websites that are relevant to the Baker Act. USF has the Florida Mental Health Institute, which contains the Baker Act Reporting Center, who receives the involuntary examination data. Also, the Baker Act training is located on our website, which is provided and listed on the second bullet. And the third bullet down, the list of receiving facilities, that's something that's typically updated monthly as receiving facilities change. And that is my contact information. And that's all I have.
Thank you, Madam Chair, of course.
I do, too.
Thank you for that presentation. In a previous life in the State Attorney's Office, one of my jobs was to handle Baker Act, so I'm familiar with them, and they're the very difficult matters to handle. I actually had two questions. First was on your slide, you showed a 9% increase in a single year for involuntary examinations. Do you know why? It's a lot of increase.
It is. I can't speak to the specific reasons why. I do have that report, which I can share with you all. It's available. It's on the University of South Florida, Florida Mental Health Institute website, and it has some breakdown of the different demographics reason for the Baker Act, breakdown of the different counties, and why the Baker Act was initiated, whether it was harm to self, others, or neglect. So that may clarify some of that, but I'm not sure exactly the specific reason for this.
I'd be interested in finding out the reasons why there was such a, what appears to be a very significant jump in a single year. And fairly recently, do we have statistics after, I think that was 2012, 2013, do we have statistics for the last year?
I don't believe that they've released it yet, but I can find out.
Yeah, I'd be interested in knowing why.
And excuse me, Ian, if you could provide trend information on that, so we can see how that's trended over the last, say, 10 years or so, that might also be helpful. Go ahead.
And then The Supreme Court, I understand, has established a task force on the Baker Act. And are you aware of that task force? And if so, do you know where they stand on recommendations in that process?
I'm aware of the task force. I'm not exactly sure specifically about their stance on recommendations, but that's something that I can look into and let you know.
Great, thank you.
So if you could, you mentioned the 171,744 exams that were initiated. Do we have any data on how many were actually substantiated? I mean, where the people were capped, where they met the Baker Act criteria?
Unfortunately, we don't. We have just that number of involuntary examinations, but as far as if they're kept, how long, we don't have that at this point.
Is that data that's kept by anyone, or?
Not that I'm aware of. AHCA, the Agency of Health Care Administration, is responsible for, and they contract with, for a mental health institute to receive the involuntary examination data. I'm not sure, I don't know if I can speak to if they are responsible for keeping any of the other data, but I don't have those numbers at this point as far as they would have stayed versus the lease right away after.
Okay. Then the other question that I have is, you mentioned that the outpatient assisted treatment criteria was more difficult. Can you elaborate on that and really kind of help me understand how Seminole County has, I guess, figured it out that they're going to have?
It's a slightly different set of criteria. So, for example, there's a requirement that there the individuals that would be involuntary, to participate in voluntary outpatient placement would have had previous failed attempted treatment attempts, possibly been non-compliant, things like that. So there's a different standard that's set, which may possibly be the reason why it's not used. I'm not exactly sure the reason why it's not, but that is one of the main differences, that they have to demonstrate that individual previously showed treatment non-compliance.
So does this require going through the court system then? Is that part of the process? So let's say that you have an individual who meets the criteria. So how do you go through the process of initiating the outpatient assisted treatment process? What does the process look like?
As far as the legal process, I don't think I can speak to that process.
Okay. So is everybody?
Oh. Madam Chair, I have one question for Ms. Thompson. Who in the legal enforcement can Baker Act someone? Any police officer or who?
I believe any law enforcement officer. I know there are law enforcement officers that are specifically trained in the crisis intervention training, but I do not believe they have to have that training in order to initiate Baker Act.
Do you think that's wise? Not having any training and then being able to Baker Act someone? That doesn't sound too wise to me. I actually did this. Now, unless the law has changed significantly since that Austin was a state attorney and I worked for him, but you had to go in front of the judge within 72 hours at that time to have any other than just to hold them. Now, when they came in, they had to have a mental health professional, I believe. It would be a psychiatrist or psychologist.
Present.
Yeah, they had to make a recommendation. And then I think within 72 hours, at least this used to be law, I don't know if it's changed or not, but within 72 hours, you had to get in front of a judge. And then, and that's when I came in as assistant state attorney, we would have that hearing as to whether or not they were harmed to themselves or to others.
That makes more sense.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right, next we have Lisa Brower, Field Office Manager with AHCA. Thanks for being here. It's good to see you.
Hey, thank you. Thank you, Judge. As a baby nurse, the best way to present to you today, because the Medicaid program, I think most of you are aware, is one of the largest funders of mental health services, public funders of mental health services in Florida and in every state. And we've had some changes. I think most of you are very aware of the managed medical, the statewide managed Medicaid medical assistance changes and managed care within the last little while. And so now, the services, it basically changed the way services are delivered under Medicaid. We contract with managed care plans to deliver services to our beneficiaries, and that does include mental health services. But there are extensive requirements in the contracts that the plans must adhere to regarding particularly all their services, but in particular mental health services. So I just wanted to outline just very briefly some of the things that the plans, both the long-term care plans and the managed medical assistance plans, have to adhere to. They have to monitor enrollees that have comorbidities and complex medical conditions, which of course would include the mental health population in many instances. They have to coordinate services for high utilizers, and of course those plans, it behooves them to look at the high utilizers first, high utilizers of services, and coordinate those plans. Services for them. They have to identify gaps in services and evaluate case management efforts. Of course, the case management now is done by the health care plans, including the behavioral health case management. They have to have an annual network plan that includes that there are sufficient number of providers and services available in the areas where they provide services. And the managed medical assistance plans have to assess and the person's health care needs, which includes the behavioral health care needs, and use their resources to provide those needs. They have to ensure proper coordination and case management. Case management is a big component of what the managed care companies are required to do, including behavioral health case management. They do have to provide outreach to homeless and other populations. I don't know if that is in the contract that they do that. And those that are at risk of justice system involvement, that outreach component would vary, you know, by plan and by region. And those that are currently involved in the system too, that ensure that services are accessible for them. But I think most people are aware that when you go into a correctional facility, that your Medicaid benefits are suspended while you're incarcerated. Most people are aware of that. So, you know, this applies up to that point. They have to have written protocols for all of these things, for the complex medical issues, high service utilization issues. And have to assure that they've identified needs across multiple domains, including transportation barriers, medication, behavioral health conditions, and preferences for treatment. Again, I want to emphasize the notion of beneficiary choice. The Medicaid Managed Care Program is a mandatory program for enrollment, but we have to ensure that there are sufficient plans and beneficiaries do have are able to walk with their feet, they're able to choose the plan that best fits their needs, and if they're not happy with that plan, or if they have medical needs that cannot be met by that plan, they do have the choice to change plans. And then there's, like most of us with our health insurance, there's an open enrollment period where they can choose a different plan if they weren't happy with the plan that they chose, or maybe they've moved, maybe have a different primary care provider. There's a number of different reasons why people would choose a different plan. So most of the things that health insurance does for us, for people who have private health insurance or Medicare, the Medicaid program does for its enrollees, and most healthcare has gone to some sort of managed care model, as has Medicaid. And we were the last to implement the managed medical assistance here. It's starting in May, so we were late with our rollout. I'd like to think that most of the transition issues have been handled. But because we were late rollout, I think there probably are still some providers that are having some small problems with billing that maybe are still out there and we're still dealing with. But I think the transition went fairly smooth around the state. But, you know, I've talked to folks in here today who told me that some plans, you know, work better for them and are easier to deal with, they feel, than other plans. I think that there still is a notion of choice. AHCA does hope to, over time, be able to release report cards for plans. That includes medical services to say, you know, this is the rate of admission for this plan, and this is the rate, you know, how long it takes before discharge, all kinds of data that show if you were a consumer choosing a plan, why you might opt for one plan over another. And that's across both medical and behavioral health issues. So, you know, we don't have it today, but that's something that we're developing, and the data is coming in to support those kinds of things for all of the managed care plans around the state. But we are in the managed care model. It's something that has been a transition process, but I think, you know, we've survived it, And I think we had, as Representative Atkins certainly knows, we had a little bit of a head start here because we were part of the pilot. But it did involve a much larger number of folks going into these managed care plans. And I think, you know, when you look at it, I think Justice Singer's justifiably proud of around the state how smoothly it did go. That's not to say that there aren't issues. And then now comes the time for assessment of quality. And I guess our only recommendation is that you look very closely at the measures that AHCA has put in place. We do have measures to measure quality. And HEDIS measures, which are national data measures, and then we have some unique measures, because we serve a unique population that most health plans don't serve. We have some measures, particularly for behavioral health, that may not exist as national measures. So look very closely at that data as it becomes available, because I think we soon, very soon, you know, we'll have a year's worth of data, because May will be here shortly. And you should be able to look at some things and decide for yourself, you know, which plans make the cut, maybe which ones we don't contract with in the future. And then also for beneficiary choice as to who they want their health care providers to be under Medicaid. Because it's we've moved to a model, we want to empower folks that are in the position to choose with this kind of data. That's the purpose. And to say that Medicaid was looking to save money, we really weren't looking to save money, because obviously I think most of you know our budget increases every year. What we had hoped to do is slow the rate of growth by using a managed care model and putting some best practices in place and really taking a close look at quality and quality-driven care. So that's kind of where we are today. Any questions?
Thank you so much. You mentioned the outreach to the homeless that's required of the managed care plans, and I know that was that issue was brought up earlier today a couple of times.
Was it?
A large population of mentally ill are homeless. Mm-hmm. So, how does AHCA determine compliance with that requirement to provide outreach?
I don't know that I can address this. I don't know if my staff have any familiarity with it. We do have a plan management unit that is up in development that's going to be in our Tampa office, in addition to the staff that are in Tallahassee to do that. But we look at all their materials and where they outreach. A lot of it's direct outreach. I know that we've done some here. Some of the plans have gone to some of the facilities to outreach to that population.
So the requirement then is to outreach to the homeless, not just the mentally ill homeless, but all of us.
Correct. That's
okay.
Right. That's right.
And then you talked about the assessment of quality, that there are specific measures to assess quality within behavioral health. Can you speak to that in a little bit more detail?
I cannot. I can get that information for you, because that's something that there's probably quite a bit of it online, though. And I'll get you the links to some of the data reports that are out there already. And some are still in development specifically for that population that's just been rolled out. You know, we have data, historic data, obviously, from the rollout of the pilot, but I don't know that we have it expanded for the new rollout.
Okay. And then the length of the contract for the managed care plans, is that 3 years, 5 years? What is, how long is the contract?
The contract is 5 years.
I was thinking 5 years.
5 years.
Yeah. It's a 5 year contract.
And so when does that, what does that renewal process look like? So I guess, so that you're initially awarded a 5 year contract, when does the renewal cycle start? I know one of the concerns that's been expressed to me is that some of these managed care plans are too big to fail. And so I want to make sure that they're providing the quality and access to care that you're not restricted.
Well, the contracting process, I mean, the agency, because it is such a lengthy process to do these huge contracts,
know,
they start early. So at least a couple of years prior to the end, they'll develop. The first documents that you'll see will be the new RFP that go out with the model contract. And then, you know, that development will, because they'll be tweaking the contract we have, and that's the process I would think that you would need to be involved in if you have those concerns, is that early on what's released for bid. So if you have concerns there, the contract development, any tweaks, I think that's something you need to get to AHCA probably early.
Okay.
If there are concerns about that.
Thank you. Any other questions? All right, thank you so much. All right, next we're going to move into our list of providers and stakeholders. We're going to ask
Catherine Burns with the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office to come first, and she will be followed by Judge Carrico. And while you're coming, let me recognize someone that probably needs no introduction in this room. The former Senator Steve Wise is here, and I just want to recognize him for being here today. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Delegation, for allowing us to speak. This is my director, Tara Wiles, and she's also going to be assisting me, especially in clipping, moving the PowerPoint. I'd like to begin by saying who we are and why we're here. We represent the Jacksonville Reentry Center, the outreach arm for the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office that assists inmates that come out of the Florida Department of Corrections returning to Duval. Our eligibility for this program is you must have been convicted in Duval County, a resident of Duval County, and returning to Duval County because our taxpayer dollars are providing reentry services for these individuals. We work with between 700 and 800 inmates a year that voluntarily participate in this 3-month program. The reduction of recidivism compared to the sheriff's office, which means any arrest in providing these services, is 40%. So it is a program that is working. However, I would like to be able to articulate to you today some of the issues that we face with offenders that are returning, and in particularly those that are returning with mental health issues. You already heard from the Florida Department of Corrections. Well, the national average of individuals that have mental health needs is between 15 and 20%, with Florida Department of Corrections articulating that 17.1% of those individuals have severe mental health disorders. The problem that we face at the Jacksonville Reentry Center, we provide the comprehensive wraparound services with transitional housing, bus passes, and other things. The issue that we face is that when individuals are returning with mental health disorders, we are never notified in any way, shape, or form in regards to the need of that client. We have inmates that are returned to us that are legally blind, in wheelchairs. One died the following day after release because he had cancer. We were not notified of that. Had we known, of course, we would have tried to then do all the more for that individual. We have individuals that are released with low literacy skills that are very, very low functioning. If the DOC had indeed filled out an application for SSI applications, we were never notified of that, so we have no opportunity to follow through with that inmate to see, indeed, had someone filled out an SSI application. So those are some of the issues that we face. We work very closely with the Department of Corrections, and indeed, they've identified with the Sheriff's Office, Baker Correctional Reentry Center, which houses the inmates that are returning, many of them returning to our community. They do come up with a release plan for those individuals with us. We work in tandem with them, but that facility does not house the inmates like at UNCI. And just like you, I too get it. My sister was violently murdered by an inmate that was released that had psychotropic needs. She was stabbed 97 times, so I get it too. I understand how critical it is for us to work in tandem and be prepared for these individuals. So what I'm going to share with you today is an opportunity for us to not wait until they come home or wait until they're homeless, but implement a national standard that has already been tested in many states that will work to do inreach into the institutions to make sure that we have these SSI and SSDI applications filled out for the inmates that meet the criteria of eligibility. We already have trained some individuals within the Florida Department of Corrections in what is called a SOAR process. The SOAR process is basically a training that SAMHSA has put together that expedites the application process for SSI. Since SOAR started in 2005, 26,269 persons that were at risk have had the SOAR process completed. The overall approval rate for individuals that
fill out the SOAR application. They have a SOAR processor. The application rate and approval is 65% on the first application. Now, any of you that know, filling out SSDI and SSI applications, it is very unusual to get it approved the very first time. So a 65% approval rate is already the national norm for filling out SOAR applications with SOAR processors. And the approval rate received on the average is within 94 days. Now, only about, if we look at individuals not going through the SOAR process, only 10 to 15% of homeless individuals, or individuals coming out of prison, we could say, receive the SSI or SSDI approval on the first try. So you're talking 65% approval on the first try versus 10 to 15%. There is a national standard that says, there's a state statute, a national standard that says that you can apply for the SSI application and submit it 45 days prior to an inmate's release. If we go with the SOAR process and it is approved within 90 days, that means we only have 45 days to carry an offender post-release until they get that SSI application process approved. There are successful models. Sing Sing, I think most people have probably heard of Sing Sing in New York. They fill out the SOAR applications, the same processors, that they're called SOAR processors, that fill it out, work with them upon release. 89% of the 100 pre-release SSI applications were approved within 59 days on average. And the SOAR in Miami, Miami-Dade has a jail diversion program, and it has a 77% a success rate on the first try for applications within 70 days. So here's the process that we've been working on with the Florida Department of Corrections to do a pilot. And that is, we have at the Jacksonville Reentry Center six case managers and a job developer that works with these individuals that are coming back to Duval County. So what we're trying to do right now, we've identified one inmate at Union CI, as we've heard about so much, that has been identified by the medical department as being eligible or most likely eligible for SSI application because of their psychosis diagnosis, there you go. Anyway, we're going to be working with them. They've identified the inmate. We know, I spoke with Horizon already, they said it takes a lot of time and they are not typically filling out the SSI applications. There's not a standard that they're held to. They verbally told me that they hand the application to the inmate. That's a lot of what's done. I'm not telling you that that's done everywhere, but that's more than norm. So this process would be that anybody that is eligible for JRAC returning to Duval County, the Jacksonville Reentry Center, returning to Duval County, if they're at a facility close enough for us to visit, we would absolutely go in and work with the multidisciplinary team that was mentioned by the Florida Department of Corrections to come up with their release plan, have the SOAR process or get all of the information regarding their medical needs and their functional issues. Functional issues are not identified by the medical staff, but the corrections officers, just like in our county jail, they document what they observe the inmate doing. So, Director, could you give an example of what would be documented by correctional staff that would count as a functional issue that would help in approving this SOAR process?
Those officers that are essentially living with those inmates, the 8 to 12 hours a day that they're working with them, will document the times that they're not acting within the range of normal individuals, when they're having to be removed from population, their responses, their verbal responses to questions, bizarre behaviors, and you know, I won't get into all of the kinds that we have, but the importance is the documentation of it. And that's something we regularly do in the course of our duties. It's just connecting that particular information back into this process, and it will aid in a great deal in making sure that all the information they need is getting into the SOAR process.
So by working with a multidisciplinary team, not only in the Florida Department of Corrections, but also in our county jail, and having identified SOAR processors, and for those that are eligible, a JRAC counselor, we can work together tandemly to make sure that that SSI, SSDI application is submitted at bingo 45 days prior to release, then we would only have to carry them for a short period of time. What I'm requesting or recommending is that we provide funding for some full-time SOAR processors, and I have broken some numbers down for you. Also, we don't have to reinvent the wheel. This is being done in many states around the country, and there are examples of interagent MOUs, agreements between Social Security and, for example, JSO or FDOC. It can be done regionally. It can be done at the state level, but we need those MOUs in place. There are already samples of them written that you can find readily. You see the link right here. It's on SOAR Pranic. There's wraparound services and support nationally for individuals that are trained in this SOAR process in order to be able to help answer any questions that they have. It's readily available at all times. Some of the issues that we have is that it takes on average 40 hours to fill out one application, okay? And that means that a SOAR processor, on average nationally, can only carry about 40 in an annual caseload.
I wanted to go on a couple of numbers. Oops.
The one that has the numbers? Okay, well, I'll just have to read it to you since I'm not seeing it on here.
Okay.
Based upon the information on the DOC website, 17% having a mental health diagnosis. Annually, 33,137 inmates are released throughout the state of Florida. Annually, that was off of their website from 2012 and 13. If 17% of those met the mental health diagnosis that is reported, that would mean that 5,666 inmates were being released around the state of Florida with major mental health disorders that need to have this application filled out. When I break that down more locally, it means that if I looked at the circuit, Clay County had 269 return, Nassau County had 88, and Duval County had 2,279 inmates return last year for a total of 2,636. If we took 17% of that locally, that's 451 inmates returning. Divide that by 40 and it tells you how many SOAR processors we need to adequately address those coming out of the state institutions. That does not include individuals in wheelchairs with low mental function or blind, okay? We're just talking about those with a severe mental health diagnosis. We also would like to have a SOAR processor full-time to work with those coming out of the county jail. This is a process that we are not waiting until they're homeless. We're not waiting until they've come home and committed a new crime. We are being proactive in this manner and reaching into the institution. The SOAR processors must be in our community because there has to be that handoff. By reaching in and working with the Department of Corrections, identifying those inmates, doing teleconferencing, we can begin this process and have it ready for them to come home and have an environment that is ready for them to not only succeed, but to have the support of the local agencies, the mental health providers, and if eligible for JREC, the 3 months of services with the case managers for JREC. When I broke that down further, if we only
work... I'm going to have to ask you to please wrap it up.
Okay. If we only work with half of those inmates, that would mean locally that there were 226 that were returning. So we would only need 7 SOAR processors, and I would also recommend that we have funding for housing for individuals for the 45 days that we would need to carry them after release.
Okay. Thank you so much. And I apologize, but we've got a very long list of people who wish to speak. And I want to make sure we hear from everyone, and we're going to finish on time at 4. So next, welcome Judge Cole. I'll ask you to go to the podium and present us with your thoughts. And followed by Judge Cole, we'll have Christine Caulfield, the Lutheran Services.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Circuit Judge Karen Cole, and I appreciate very much being invited to be here today And I'm very grateful to the Duval delegation for its interest in this topic and for bringing us all together. This is an issue not only of public health, but also of public safety. Certainly not all persons with mental illness commit crimes, but many of those who commit crimes have mental illness. And when you're going to hear a lot of different statistics at varying times coming from various academic institutions, various agencies, and there are jail statistics, jails being local, and prison statistics, prisons being state level. National statistics suggest that of those who are in a prison, 30% of women and 14% of men suffer from some form of mental illness. I won't spend time on the next issue because it's clear that this has been addressed by a number of people already, but we cannot address mental illness in a vacuum. We're going to have to address housing and substance abuse at the same time, because if you are on the streets, there is no way that you are going to keep your mental health appointments or take your medication prescribed by your provider. And interestingly, with regard to the link between mental illness and substance abuse, there was something that came across my desk just this past week or so. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration has now done a study that shows that a significant percentage of the very worst of our DUI offenders, the repeat offenders who come in with five and six, incredibly, or more DUI offenses, those individuals are significantly more likely than most to have a mental illness accompanying their substance abuse. So we may be saving lives on the highways of our state when we address this issue. This is an issue for all of us. It certainly is one for the courts, because we see the issues of mental health arise in all different types of cases, in delinquency cases involving young people who have violated the law, in dependency, which are cases of child abuse, child neglect. We see certainly the issues in misdemeanor and felony cases, and we see them in family cases even, sometimes in very sad cases, in certain dissolutions of marriage, or in paternity cases, and absolutely we see them in cases involving domestic violence injunctions. And my sense is that the courts see mental health problems with greater frequency than we see them in the community, because the most intractable life problems are those presented to judge and jury. And those problems very often stem from the unidentified and untreated mental illness. The JCCI report, which was issued recently, I know that Ben Warner is here, I think that it is a marvel of excellent, independent, collaborative work by people who are skilled in the subject matter area. So I would urge the delegation to consider that report as a roadmap for interventions and statutory changes by the legislature. I think you probably know that about 15 of us from kind of all walks of life, Representative Jones with us, Derek Gilliam from the Times Union, Director Wiles. There are lots of people in this room, and I know I'm leaving some out, that went down to Miami to see what Judge Stephen Leifman has done down there. He has been a pioneer for about 15 years, dedicated his life to improving the court's ability to deal with mental illness. And I want to tell you an unexpected thing that happened because of his work. I think this will appeal to you, and I think it will appeal to the citizens that you serve. Because of the many mental health initiatives that he started, the arrests of the mentally ill in Miami and Dade County dropped so dramatically that they were able to close an entire jail, at a savings to the citizens of $13 million per year. And then, on top of that, because they had trained all of their officers in what's called crisis intervention training, something that Director Wiles is doing here in Jacksonville, the officers learned how to de-escalate situations with the mentally ill. Consequently, not only were there fewer arrests, but there were fewer altercations, and therefore there were fewer injuries to officers. Workers' compensation claims by officers dropped, and workers' comp premiums for the state went down. So there's a lot of being very practical about this. There is a lot of money that can be saved by doing the right thing. And all or a substantial percentage of those monies can be redeployed to provide the services that we don't currently have but desperately need. A couple of quick suggestions regarding things that other speakers said. With regard to the SOAR program, which is an absolutely amazing program and a core part of Judge Leifman's program in Miami, it might be possible to approach the Jacksonville Bar Association to see if lawyers who specialize in working on Social Security cases might donate pro bono hours, because lawyers have to report the number of their pro bono hours to the Florida Supreme Court every year. And so this would be a wonderful way. They could either handle a SOAR case individually, or perhaps they could get involved in some SOAR training of processors. And then with regard to the 45 days that the jail would need to see if they could find some residents for people being released, the Salt Walker Center, I believe, has a program that's recently started that takes appropriate individuals who have mental health problems and diverts them away from the system to the Sulzbacher Center, where they receive additional services. So that might be an option that could cover the 45-day period that was earlier discussed. I know that my time here is brief, so I want to thank you again for convening all of us and for your interest in this important topic. And I'll be happy to answer any questions if you have any.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Judge Cole, for your presentation. And I certainly, as a practicing lawyer in Jacksonville, don't want to put you on the spot. I would like to ask you, you know, the courts are on the front line on this.
Yes.
They see this day in, day out. They see it whether they're in the criminal court or in civil, family, juvenile. They see it every day. They see it all the time.
Entirely correct.
And they deal with our Florida statutes that, of course, are constrained by those statutes. Given your experience and the court's experience, what statutory changes would you recommend, which you think would make the greatest difference?
Well, I would join Judge Leifman in Miami in urging a complete overhaul of the Baker Act. And while we're at it, the Marchman Act. I think the procedures, frankly, have some issues of due process. I think that too many inmates are released with medication for 30 days, and there's supposed to be follow-up, and perhaps there is, but we're not seeing the results of what I would expect from a follow-up. That's probably a different practical issue than the statutory language, but the process of instituting Baker Acts, in my view, needs to be significantly modified. I think most judges would agree with me on that, by the way.
And I also understand you're probably all aware that I think the Supreme Court has done a task force. I don't know where they are on that. I don't know if you know where they are on that issue. What about the impact of mental health courts? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
I think the impact of mental health courts varies widely across the state, depending on how the courts are operating. I think that here in Duval County, the actual hearings are conducted by a general magistrate rather than by a judge. And then the general magistrate makes recommendations to the chief judge, and who either follows them or rejects them and takes other appropriate action. I think that I would again follow probably the model that we've seen in Dade County. It seems to be very effective. I think there is a role for general magistrates to play, and I think that the general magistrate who runs at our court is very dedicated and very interested in this topic, and I certainly would like to get his input on the issue as well. But there is so much potential for mental health courts, and we can certainly look across the country through the academic literature and find those that have been most successful and then replicate what they did.
All right, then I do. So when you say that the effectiveness of mental health courts varies widely, then to me that means it varies widely because perhaps they're being implemented in different manners. And perhaps they're being implemented in different manners because they're not codified in the state statute. So I would ask you the same question I asked one of our earlier presenters. Do you believe that that would be helpful to codify that into state law, how mental health courts are run?
That's an excellent question. And it's not a black or white answer. I think that there probably should be some codification of what mental health courts look like so that we don't have wide disparities in how they're operated. And I think that any codification should be based on best practices found in the mental health literature, mental health and legal literature. But I would hate to see the codification become such a straitjacket that mental health courts lose the flexibility that they need to customize their work with each individual, because as we all know, every person's going to be a little bit different for it. Yes, I would agree with you. I think it would be helpful to have a structure that was common in all circuits.
So codification with flexibility.
Yes.
Okay, good. Thank you. And you talked about overhaul of the Baker Act and the Merchant Act. Do you have any specific recommendations? You know, overhaul can look like anything. Is there any one thing with the Baker Act or the Marchman Act that you think is broken that needs to be fixed?
I think that too many of our Baker Acts present themselves as a one-sided proceeding where, because the matter is deemed to be an emergency, the party who is the subject of the proceeding is not present, is not heard from, is not represented by counsel. I think that there should be a high standard for having a proceeding that could involuntarily confine someone for evaluation and treatment. Or actually, the only time that would happen would be for evaluation before the proceeding. You wouldn't have an ongoing treatment in that sort of a process. But I do think that it's such a serious matter that it should be very difficult to come before a court without having served the other party. If that party is indigent, provided them an opportunity to have court-appointed counsel.
Thank you. And then finally, you made the statement that you're not really seeing the results of the follow-up that one would expect when you've got an individual with mental illness who's released from a state prison, maybe even from a jail. That would be another question. What sort of kind of wraparound services do we have, if any, for mentally ill that are being released from the jails? Who actually is responsible for those results? I mean, is there, and maybe I need to go over here, but who's actually responsible for making sure that when a mentally ill person is released from prison or from a jail, that they are linked up with services? Who's got that responsibility?
If anyone.
I can answer that. For the prison system, we are. We take responsibility. We coordinate with the Department of Children and Family Services. We have an MOA so that all individuals who are receiving medication or entered into substance abuse, mental health, or the chronic referral system, information is sent to the Department of Children and Families. They identify where the community mental health center is. And we contact the mental health center. This is all done electronically. Mm-hmm. So the appointment is made, confirmed 30 days upon release. The treatment summary is sent to the community mental health center. The problem is many inmates don't show up. So without the inreach and somebody following throughout, all we can do is say we've provided the continuity of care required for reentry, but we can't make the first appointment.
Okay, so the Department of Corrections creates the link. You're responsible for the link and only the link. And so you send that link to the community mental health center. So should not the community mental health center then have the responsibility to provide that in reach to help ensure that individual keeps their appointment?
I sat on the Supreme Court, Judge Lackman's task force for years. That was one of the ideas, was to have the people at the community mental health centers have a designated behavioral health care representative clinician who's trained in the criminal justice system to do the reach-in. So if the person got picked up for a petty violation of the DOP, he'd go before the court and intercede, say, look, we're going to follow this guy, make sure he gets picked up for service.
But even before the individual gets picked up, should we not have a case manager or whoever with the community mental health center responsible for proactively going out and meeting this person and ensuring that their needs are being met?
Yes.
Yes, I see your head shakes. But is that not happening? Because I hear you say that you're not seeing the results of that.
If I can add to what you were saying, I think that if we are going to see change, we are going to have to think differently about what our responsibility is and where it is. I'll give you an example. Part of Judge Lackey's programs in Miami involves individuals who go to a psychiatric hospital on the grounds of Jackson Memorial Hospital. One individual was released and was placed in a group home setting, which immediately fell apart. And he called in a panic. The person managing the group home called in a panic, and the psychiatrist sent a hospital van out to get the person and brought the person back and immediately found alternate housing. Now, she did not have to do that. Mm-hmm. Some people could argue that she really didn't have any authority to do that. But she did it, and the person thrived in the second placement. Judge Lackman also has peer counselors who do what you're talking about. They follow up with the individual who doesn't show up, because you can pretty much count on the fact that someone gets out of prison, they've got a mental health problem, they're given an appointment, they're not going to go. So you're going to have peer counselors who have been through this process. They have had mental health problems themselves, and they have been stabilized. They know every trick in the book. They know every excuse in the book. And they will go hunt down these people, which often doesn't take much more than going to where they were staying before they went to prison, and talk with them, encourage them, transport them to the appointment, do whatever it takes. In fact, I would suggest that is the motto that we need to have. We will do whatever it takes.
That's about ending the problem.
Yes.
Thank you so much. We are running way behind schedule, so we're going to ask Christine Caulfield to come next, and she'll be followed by Mark Fontaine. And then it'll be Lori Costantino Brown. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you very much, Representative, the delegation members, for this opportunity to share a glimpse of the past, present, and future of our behavioral health care system. I'm a licensed clinical psychologist and the CEO of the second largest managing entity in the state of Florida. And we serve 150,000 individuals throughout a 23-county region in northeast and north central Florida. I'm also representing the Florida Association of Managing Entities today. My responsibility to learn from the past and lead for the future is paramount. But first, let's examine a person with a healthcare journey through our present system with a chronic condition in our healthcare system. So I'd like you to imagine that you have a chronic illness like heart disease. You have not been diligent with your exercise regimen, and you've been eating a lot of forbidden foods throughout the holiday season. You suffer a heart attack, and you're rushed to the emergency room, where physicians work to stabilize you. Tests indicate that you require open heart surgery. After surgery, you're transferred to a cardiac step-down unit and monitored for post-surgery recovery. Upon discharge from the hospital, you are referred for weekly cardiac outpatient rehab for 6 months. You are also referred to psychoeducational groups to learn more about your disease, understand your new medications, and learn from other peers in the group that have chronic heart disease. You also have been prescribed home health care to address your wound care. Your family is also involved in your recovery, as they want to learn more about your illness and how to best assist you with emotional support, healthy lifestyle, education, and so on. As you can see, you've had many levels of care throughout your health crisis, from acute care to subacute care to outpatient and to in-home care. Now let's look at Florida's past funding history for behavioral health care. Notorious for being 49th out of 50 in funding, The state chose to fund dollars available for our acute care system, our most expensive health care system. So our state dollars typically funded state hospitals, inpatient mental health units, substance abuse units, crisis stabilization units, and detox units. Comparably speaking, the remaining few dollars were spent on outpatient services. Unlike the heart patient, who was able to continue his healing process long after the acute heart attack episode ended, our Floridians with chronic and persistent mental health conditions such as depression or addiction rarely receive the appropriate follow-up care that is necessary for full recovery. Now, lately we've experienced a tidal wave of tragedies, both nationally and in our state. The shock and disbelief of these tragedies haunts us all. How could a gunman open fire on our college campus? How could a parent kill his own child? The common thread weaving through these national headline news stories is mental health and substance abuse disorders. We must do what it takes to end the outcomes for our children, for our families, and for our communities. My colleagues here today, and there are many, and I stand ready to work hand in hand with each and every one of you to work for true system transformation. Presently, we need to move from triaging the emergency to treatment, the right treatment at the right time in the right setting to enable us to transform our children, our families, our communities, which now requires us to transform our current behavioral health system of care. Transforming our current system of care requires the following. Transforming the way we currently fund by allowing flexible spending and blended rates with an expanded focus on prevention and early intervention. Transforming the way we triage by increasing mobile crisis units and community assessment teams. Transforming the way we treat by increasing the presence of peer support specialists, diversion programs, and on-site services in schools, jails, prisons, and family homes, utilizing best practice models and innovative programs. Transforming our system of care by inviting new public and private collaborations, philanthropic partnerships, creating legislative policies to enhance care services. We need to have better integration of system of care that our clients often touch, such as the VA system, emergency rooms, jails, prisons, child welfare systems of care, Department of Juvenile Justice, and many more. Silos must be broken, and sharing of data is essential. Integrated care coordination teams are crucial to ensure that the most vulnerable citizens no longer fall through the cracks, as exemplified by your example, Representative Atkins, and your concerns. To ensure that these individuals follow through with their medication compliance and their aftercare plans. At LSF Health Systems, we have implemented 5 care coordination teams that are monitoring 5 high-risk, high-utilizing individuals and populations. The five following populations are as follows. State hospital residents, jail and forensic, homeless, child welfare, and crisis stabilization units. We're working with our provider agencies to ensure that proper discharge and wraparound services are in place in order to reduce cost, reduce recidivism, and restore recovery. We need more care coordination teams. We recently funded 5 integrated care teams throughout our region that consist of intervention and wraparound services for these high-risk and high-utilizing populations that I just identified. We need more funding for more integrated care teams. In order for this transformation to occur, our system of care requires the following. eliminate the silos of funding for substance abuse and mental health services such that funding can meet the needs of the consumer rather than the funding driving the services the consumers need. We need to allow program funding to be used for the whole family. Because Medicaid has become very successful at enrolling children, a substantial amount of children's funding is being lapsed. This needed funding could be better utilized by allowing the dollars being used to treat the adults in the family, which in turn results in healing for the child. We request that AUCAS Medicaid authorization and payment data is available to managing entities in real time so that the managing entity can better ensure that we are payers of last resort for the indigent population needing behavioral health care services. Statewide standard upload system data warehouse approach to provide reporting and collection. This will allow the managing entity reporting and exchange of data to the department. We need to allow contracts with the managing entities more flexibility such that funding can readily be shifted without the need of a contract amendment, which often takes 3 months or longer. All funding, programs, and member projects need to go through the managing entity because we need to remove administrative duplication of the department through direct appropriations. We have united with our partner organizations and Department of Children and Families to submit additional recommendations that we all support for this transformation. In closing, Florida is considered the vanguard of many issues. We have low taxes, a leader in job growth, high school graduation rate drastically improved in the past 7 years. However, we need to raise our rank of 49 for mental health service expenditures. Florida spends $39.55 per capita. The national average for funding for mental health services is $120. If we were to restore funding to the year 2000 level, adjusted for inflation, we would require an investment from Florida legislature of over $129 million. We certainly recognize that this is a monumental request. However, just as the governor has recently outlined a $5 billion plan for the Everglades that would begin with $300 million in the upcoming year, we need a similar graduated funding plan for our Floridians who are suffering with mental health and substance abuse disorders. I look forward to meeting with each and every one of you as we work together to find solutions that will truly transform our behavioral health system of care so that Floridians can embrace recovery and become productive contributors to our communities. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I have a question for you. I know to a great extent we use targeted case management.
Yes.
Talk to me about intensive case management for those cases, because you referenced the integrated care coordination teams, which sounds very, very deep and very expensive. I can understand how the targeted case management might work for some individuals, but for others, there might be a middle ground where we need intensive case management services. Can you talk a little bit about that and what you think the benefits of that might be?
Yes, I can. The intensive case management services are really desperately needed to ensure that people don't fall through the cracks. That's where we're seeing the problems from the handoffs from the jails, prisons, crisis stabilization units back into the community or to the provider agency. We need to be in those sites prior to discharge, wrapping our arms around these folks and ensuring that they receive the services that they desperately need. And intensive case managers are part of that core integrated team that does just that. They're like the traffic cop, if you will.
So if you looked at having kind of a blend, if you will.
Yes.
Can you just give me an estimate of how many of the people that you provide case management to, how many of those are fine under the targeted case management versus what percentage of those do you think would really benefit from the intensive case management and thereby actually cost the state less?
Right. I think that if you have an addition of an intensive case manager rather than a targeted case manager, for example, but that person is part of a team, and the team, frankly, could be much less expensive than a fact team presently. What we really need in these wraparound teams are an individual, a clinician that can prescribe the medications, which less we can step down from psychiatry to ARNP. So we need somebody that can prescribe the meds. We need a therapist because we know that best practice for treating mental health issues is medication plus psychotherapy. And we need the case manager to make sure all these individuals are working together, wrapping themselves around this client, and a peer support specialist. And that four-member team can do wonders in ensuring that our individuals are getting the care that they need.
So you mentioned that the intensive case management is a much less expensive model than the FACT team.
Yes.
Who is responsible for the FACT team? Is that DCF? Do we have any data as to the effectiveness of the FACT team? I know they've been around for several years, but have we ever taken a look at, are they adhering to those best practices, those models, and what are the outcomes that they're really achieving for the cost? Do we know that? Could we get that information?
Yeah, we may be able to get that information. I don't have it currently, but we should be able to get something.
So, Christine, maybe you can help me. On the intensive case management versus the FACT team, what's kind of the caseload for the different,
right,
one versus the other? Do you know?
Yes, the integrated care teams that are assigned to clients, the typical client load for the case management part is around 30 individuals. That ARNP that you're funding can certainly be part of other integrated care teams because that individual is not seeing that client as frequently.
Okay, thank you. All right, any other questions? You're really behind now.
Thank you.
And I know, okay, so Mark Fontaine, followed by Lori Costantino. We have about 57 minutes left, so I apologize to all the future speakers. We have about 13 speakers, so if we can limit it to like 4 minutes, I would appreciate it.
We'll talk fast. Mark Fontaine, Florida Alcohol and Drug Abuse Association. I'm a statewide organization that represents the providers that do this work. Let me give you a little context. Christine said the U.S. average for the mental health spend is $120.56. Florida is $39.55. Georgia is $46.54. Alabama is $78.19. South Carolina is $59.75. Mississippi is $114.95. So we are significantly below the states in our peers. So money is one of the issues, certainly. Let me address this whole notion about trying to keep people in the community, because that's where we win. We win when we keep people in the community. When they go to prison, then it all becomes more complicated and more costly, and just the step down becomes more difficult. So what do we need to do to keep people in the community? We've talked about several of these already. CIT, we need to do CIT. There needs to be more options for law enforcement to do CIT. The sheriffs are going to be coming to the legislature and say we need some help with that. That's a good program. It's very successful. It helps de-escalate. Second thing is we need the concept of triaging and how do we best do triaging. And we need to, and if you look at the Orlando model, if you look at what Judge Lightman's doing in Miami, you see where communities have gotten together and put resources together in order to triage these people so that law enforcement doesn't have to take them to jail. Law enforcement can take them to triage down in Fort Myers, the Bob James Center. where they can take them to triage so you don't have to penetrate them into the justice system. And then you move them from there into a services, into a case management system. So one of the strategies we have available in statute and in practice, but not enough resources, is the community reinvestment grants, substance abuse, mental health, criminal justice reinvestment grants. So what the state says is, because we know this is a community problem, we're gonna match your money 100%. And you design your own solution to keep mental health people from entering the system. And that is working. It's working in communities across Florida. We need to do more of that. Communities will do more of that if they know the funding's going to be there and that opportunity is there to do that. Mental health courts, not in statute. It could be in statute. I know some of the legislation that's being proposed has already shifted that into 394. Putting the mental health courts, it's only in 397 is drug courts. So that's a critical. Assisted outpatient is a funding issue. People don't use it because it's a funding issue. It's costly. It's more costly than the resources that are available. And the sheriff will tell you down in Seminole County that he was able to get resources, and that's how he was able to do that. And he'll tell you, because he was at the Justice Summit last week, that he's been able to save a lot of money on his jail and then convert that over because he was able to make that shift. We have community drug treatment beds in the Department of Corrections called secure and non-secure drug treatment beds. We have 1,244 of those beds. At one time, we had 1,969, and they got cut. Well, we now have 43 of those beds that have a co-occurring focus. The governor in his budget yesterday put an additional 100 of those beds in his budget. That's a place where we can put some more co-occurring focus and, again, try to keep low-end mental health folk in the community. You have passed legislation called the Post-Adjudicatory Drug Court Program. What that did is it allowed at 42 points, you went to 44 points, you went to prison. And the legislature twice has now extended the points up to 60, where you can stay in the community and not automatically go to prison. We should look at that for mental health cases. Are there some of these cases that we could keep in the community if we could wrap the services around them? A few other suggestions. We need statewide data system, and we've got to get that right this time. We all struggle with, well, what's your data, what's your treatment, what's your outputs, what's your outcomes? And everybody's collecting, the providers are sending it to the managing entities and sending it to Tallahassee, and for some reason we can't get reports out, and we need to fix that problem. Care coordination, Representative Atkins, this is exactly what you're talking about. And in the governor's budget is a proposal of using federal money that we already have sitting in the state to use it for care coordination, which would be to people stepping out of jails, prisons, CSUs, detox, and state hospitals, that we put a care coordinator that will link them to services and help them transition so that they're not just moving through those high-end services frequently. And I agree with a lot of what Christine said in terms of flexibility of funding. We got to get outside the buckets. We've got to be able to serve families and not just children. And we need to look more at mental health first aid. But I also want to tell you, the Department of Corrections, we put on 3 reentry centers in the last 3 years. There are 433 beds each, and each one of them now have 50 mental health beds. So they're primarily drug treatment facilities, but now we have mental health beds also in there. So it'll be the first time the inmates end their sentence inside a facility that's actually helping them get prepared to step down. Right down the street, you have a program called Reality House, where inmates spend the last 18 months of their sentence in a community drug treatment program. We can do the same thing for mental health. We just have to do it. We have to create those kind of community options where you step people down from prison. They're still serving their sentence, the end of their sentence, but they're serving it in a community facility that's going to help them transition back into the street like JREC does, essentially. So those are just some suggestions.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Okay, so I want all the other presenters to follow his model. I'm just giving your suggestions so I can get through everyone. Next, we're going to hear from Lori Constantino Brown, and she will be followed by Denise Formulo. Thank you so much for being here. If you could keep it 4 minutes.
I will. My name is Lori Constantino Brown, and I'm with Bridges of America. I am a treatment provider here in the state of Florida, and particularly a provider of services here in Duval County. We have a 400-bed facility that works with court diversion for substance abuse and also reentry down on AGMAC. Come and see us. What I want to talk about, in addition to working in the state, Bridges works in 14 other states. And so we've gotten an opportunity to kind of compare and see why these outcomes are so different. And I'd like to answer a couple of things. First of all, you cannot really impact the correctional system if you don't impact the community sources. And the community is grossly under-sourced. And whether you're dealing with the courts and the jails, or even with corrections and reentry, recently, the National Alliance on Mental Health gave Florida a D grade. We barely made the D. We were right on the cusp in their categories of an F, and they only did that to six states. The biggest issues were our gaps in service and the availability of resources. And so, again, there's been report after report after report that talks about these things and these lacks of services. You mentioned drug court, for example, and why it varies in the kind of results it gets. And I can tell you a real simple answer. Resources. It's kind of like trying to build a house with just a screwdriver. Okay? You've got to have a number of tools and resources to have effective diversion. When those things aren't in the community, then these judges are straying a hold to what they can do and how they can do it. And where I've seen drug courts in other states work wonderfully is when there's been great partnerships with the providers in the community, with the jail, with the judges, for what you heard today, some of these seamless systems. Currently, in the same report on the National Alliance of Mental Health, it said that one third of the adults and only one fourth of the children are getting publicly funded services that need it. Okay, so I mean, we've got to look at the fact that these resources, no matter how we dance around them, is coming back. My recommendation, as I've seen it done in other states, is simple. We need an entire reform to the way we do mental health in the state, and really come together with the partnership of the governor's office, legislation, and the various offices you've already heard from. Figure out where these gaps of services are and begin to put an implementation plan over a period of a year, 2 years, 5 years, whatever it takes to get us where we need to be, because Florida's population continues to increase as well, and the demand is just getting bigger and bigger. And I just don't think that, as I heard earlier mentioned, we've been in this crisis for so long that we've kind of just learned to live with it. But unfortunately, for those that are suffering from this, if you have a child, for example, that needs services, God help you, you won't get them. You'll be put on waiting lists forever. We've seen it. So it's really kind of one of these things where we really have to really step back and do a 30,000-foot view and look at the big picture and create that reform that's needed, or we're going to just continue to spin and spiral out of control. And I think that Florida can do much better than that.
Thank you so much. Next, we have Denise Marzullo of No Hope America, Northeast Florida, and she will be followed by Debbie O'Neill.
Good afternoon. I have a handout for you guys, so it will give more detail. When we closed the state hospitals, the money was supposed to go into community-based care, everything everyone's been talking about. And throughout the past 5 decades, we continue to cut so that all of our funding is going into the deep end services, the bottom level of the pyramid. We need to flip that. We need to start putting funding into prevention. We need to start putting funding into more care coordination, as has been discussed. The SOAR model, as Catherine so eloquently talked about, which is very effective in reducing the deep end crisis stabilization services. We do have a couple of recommendations, as Mr. Fontaine talked about. We do want to fund the criminal reinvestment grants. We think that those are critical to our community to stop the cycle of the 30 days worth of medication, whether they're coming out of a crisis stabilization unit or a jail or a prison, they're given the 30 days worth of medication, and then there's not much follow-up. So we need funding that's focusing on the prevention and the diversion, the SOAR model, the care coordination, put into the facilities so that we can help these individuals while we have them, so we can follow up with them afterwards, including the peer specialists. That's how Judge Lightman's programs have been so successful in Miami, is that they focus on having the peer specialists work with the individuals before they leave the crisis stabilization units, the jails, the prisons, the court system. We also are recommending House Bill 281, allowing the ARNPs, the Advanced Registered Nurse Practitioners, to have full prescribing privileges. Florida is the only state that has that restriction on our nurse practitioners. We have such a shortage of psychiatrists right now in our community. We have about 1,300 in the state of Florida. We need 1,800. That's creating capacity issues, huge wait lists. Our ARNPs are fully trained, are highly capable of prescribing these controlled substances. We just don't allow it. They have to work under the direction of the medical doctors. And so if we were to allow and pass that bill, our nurse practitioners would be able to fill a very significant gap in our mental health system, and that's critical. We also need to, as funding has been addressed, we can't not address it. We've got to start funding an increase in the Medicaid reimbursement rates. Our providers are providing services at levels that were back in the 90s. Because of that, we're not able to have the quality of the therapists that we need and the case management services that we need to fill this gap, to provide services to this critical population. And we've got to look at the Healthy Florida Works program, the Medicaid expansion. Passing that would allow 1.2 million Floridians to have eligibility to have Medicaid, which would pay for the ongoing care, which would save our system millions of dollars in costly services. It's a prevention strategy, and it's critical to our community. And I do have data on the question that you asked. It costs $50 more a day to house a mentally ill inmate in our jails and prisons than someone who doesn't have a mental illness, due to the fact that we're then prescribing the medications and having a psychiatrist. So those are our recommendations.
Thank you so much. Thank you. All right, next members, we'll hear from Debbie O'Neill.
And I'm Mara Reddy.
Very good. And then after Debbie, we'll have Dr. Ellen Williams with Baptist.
Okay, thank you again for being interested in this this topic that's very important to most of us in this room. I had a speech that I was going to tell you in 5 minutes, but hearing some of the topics that have been discussed and some of the gaps and some of the questions that you have entertained, I want to try to go back over a few highlights. You know, I hear what the Department of Corrections is doing, and I applaud what they're doing to try to meet the needs of persons with mental illness that now have been, I want to say, diverted to the correction system, out of our mental health system. But I think it's also kind of sad that we're trying to come up with best practice models to treat the mentally ill in our Department of Corrections instead of trying to go back to see what do we need to do in our mental health system. When we have our correction facilities over capacity in our mental health beds, and we only have less than 40 clients from this area sitting in our state hospital, it tells you that we have shifted the burden, and I think we've done a disservice. When Pat Hogan talked about her brother being in jail currently, it's a sad situation when a family member probably feels a sense of relief that at least they're safe. that they're not going to get a call that something has happened to them or to somebody else in the community because of their actions. So from policy statements, I think we need to go back and look at exactly what is it that we're funding in our state mental health system. Since the 80s, since I have been in the field, we used to have the continuum of care of services offered in the community. Now we are funding deep end services. So our individuals that we are trying to serve are cycling in and out of our crisis stabilization units, our psych hospitals, our jails, prisons. We're not offering that community-based level of care. In the 80s and early 90s, we had over 150 residential treatment beds serving people with mental illness in our community. And today, do you know how many we have in our community? Zero. We have zero beds. So you go from a crisis stabilization unit, 4.5 days average stay, and I do have the Baker Act data that was cited that you asked about that I can give you. 4.5 average length of stay. They go into the community. They don't have a residential treatment bed. They don't even have an SRT in this area that can give them longer stabilization. So either they cycle back into the CSUs and have these multiple admissions, they end up getting arrested, they go to our local jail. If it's a felony, they end up going to prison. And so again, we have shifted the burden to that system. You also asked questions about the FACT program, the Florida Assertive Community Treatment. It is an evidence-based program. They're 31 in the state of Florida. We happen to operate two of them in Jacksonville. There's 31 around the state. We do have to maintain fidelity to the evidence best practice model. It's very scripted. It is successful. There is data that is supported, submitted to the department on the outcomes. It serves 100 individuals, and it is a very intensive program. It costs about $12,000 per client per year, which may seem expensive until you start adding up how much we're paying for that. Those clients that would then be served in the CSU's hospitals or the jails or the prisons. The intensive case management model program, we've tried very similar programs here, Baker Act Recovery Support Program, where you had dedicated staff that actually did field-based work with these individuals that can't come to traditional office-based services. Unlike the individual that has the heart attack and has to go to rehab, they have transportation, they have family support. Many of our individuals are not going to independently go to a doctor's appointment. They need those services provided in the community. We've offered those in the past with good outcomes where you have that wraparound model in the community. Funding has been cut. Again, as it was mentioned, Medicaid funding is 60% less than what the cost of the service is. We cannot keep mental health professionals in the field. They're going to work for managed care companies. We can't get psychiatrists. Okay. And let's see. Let me make sure I got everything. Again, FACT programs do serve a value, and I do wish we could expand FACT programs throughout the state. Some communities do not have them. Assisted outpatient, the Baker Act. Please, please, please. That is what is creating a big gap in our system. It was developed in a way to protect the rights of individuals, and what's happened is that those people that are having the multiple CSU admissions that are murdering their moms, killing their stepfather, it's because once they leave and they no longer have that imminent risk of danger, and they no longer meet involuntary status, they're going back into the community and they're choosing not to follow up in treatment. And so you have them creating that risk in our community. The assistant outpatient treatment programs, although it was an attempt to force these individuals to get outpatient treatment, again, it requires a judicial process. They get a public defender. You have to prove they're at imminent danger without this treatment. And so we do not believe we would be able to meet that burden of proof with many of the consumers. So that's it, and I'll leave this with your aid.
Thank you so much. Next, we're going to hear from Dr. Ellen Williams, followed by Dr. Candace Hodgkins. And we're now down to about 3 minutes. I apologize.
Okay.
Talk fast.
kind of race through this. First of all, just representing the private provider, I work at Baptist Health and the Administrator for Behavioral Health. Just to reiterate, people have been saying about increasing volumes. Our occupancy rates have gone from 85% to 80% a couple of years ago to 95% to 100%. Last week, we had 13 big rats holding an RED, and the week before that, we had 9 adults and 4 children waiting for beds. So our capacity is over the top, and that's true across all of our programs. We have partial hospital programs, we have inpatient programs for adults, geriatrics, and children. They're all at full capacity. My outpatient providers, we have about 30 to 35 of them right now. Half of them are not seeing new patients because their caseloads are so full. So this is a private provider. This isn't about Medicaid necessarily. We have very few Medicaid patients on our caseloads, but it's really, I mean, I hate to use the word crisis over and over, but the statistics really show that we have to have some solutions. So I'm going to help you. I'm going to just talk about some solutions. I think part of the problem with the increased volume is recidivism, of course. And we have a task force at Baptist that is looking at that. And we've identified that there are 3 co-related issues that are creating most of the recidivism problems. Schizophrenia, homelessness, substance abuse, all in one individual. That's what's creating the problems in the EDs. And upon discharge, these people, even though we try to find follow-up appointments, that's part of a requirement for when we discharge people, we have to have a follow-up appointment. There's really nowhere for them to go. There are very limited hours for people who don't have health care for them to get services. And if they even can get there, because most of them don't have transportation, and they can't think how to solve problems, because they're ill, and they can't figure out how to get to the solve problem to get their prescriptions filled. So they really need some care of managers, and that costs money. So how do we reduce acute psych problems that create recidivism? We have to create some all-day and evening clinic hours so people aren't turned away by 10 o'clock in the morning to fill their prescription medications. We have to create some supportive housing for known recidivists that have care managers and wraparound services that can get them to and from their appointments. We also have to really look at creating a trauma-responsive community. 45% of childhood-onset psychiatric disorders result from trauma or adversity. Once a child is traumatized, and if they're traumatized repeatedly, they turn into the people that we're seeing in our EDs right now. So we have to have a prevention program, we have to have a trauma response to the community, and we have to provide the services that keep people out of prison, out of IEDs. Some of the things that we saw with Judge Wiseman down in Miami, I'm just going to reiterate it, the crisis and intervention training for law enforcement staff, the SOAR processing to get people benefits so that they can see more providers and have better access to care, the wraparound care management resources, and peer specialists. We do have peer specialists in our mental health courts here in Jacksonville. Their caseload is 20 to 1. One case manager, 20 people. In Miami, the caseload ratio is 1 to 1. That's why they're successful. It costs money, but it works, so they stay out of the system. There's also a problem about a shortage of providers in this community. Baptist has created with UF Health an emergency program for psychiatry. We need to have 3 rotating through right now. We need 3 more slots for child psychiatry. We have them only for adult psychiatry now. This is the way to retain and recruit people for our community. Create the training programs from here. That's where they're most likely will stay. The same thing is happening. We're creating a fellowship program for clinical psychology in collaboration with the Moores. That has to be part of our training and recruiting process here in Jacksonville and Northeast Florida. Get some psychology training programs, get some psychiatry training programs, and then you can increase capacity so that people have places to go for care. Thank you.
Thank you so much. All right, next we will hear from Debbie O'Neill, followed by, Dr. Candace Hodgkins, followed by Jim DeGregory.
Hi, I'm at the speaker table here, and I'm not quite sure why I'm not up there, but I'm just going to sit here, and I'm going to go really fast, because I have a lot of colleagues in the room that want to speak, and I'm just going to synthesize. We need to decriminalize mental health and substance abuse. Why does it become a criminalized situation? It's because we don't put money up front with children, and those children don't get treatment, and then they become adolescents who go through our DJJ system. And then they get out of DJJ and they become oftentimes criminals in the adult population because they have severe issues and there's not enough community-based resources. I don't know how many more times we have to say that, but the reality is I've been in Jacksonville for 17 years. I work at Gateway Community Services. I apologize for not announcing that first. And we are an addiction treatment facility who gets no mental health dollars. And our dollars through DCF, now LSF, have not increased in the 17 years I've been there. So we're working on the same dollars that we have 17 years ago. We treated at Gateway 5,170 individual people. These are not duplicated numbers. This is how many adults came through our system. Out of that, 73% were treated with LSF dollars. We get $4.1 million and some change. That's $1,000 a person if you just had each person that came through. That's all that's allocated to each person. Now, obviously, we have other funding sources, sometimes 30 to 40 different funding sources to help us support the people that 50% of our annual income is provided through LSF, but 73% of those people take up our resources. So it is a crisis issue. Also support flexible funding. We have the silos of mental health and substance abuse. That doesn't do anybody in the community any good. It actually creates more fracture than it does collaboration. And so we need those to go away at some time. You need to reform the whole system, like everybody's been saying. And ARNP prescribers are absolutely a huge need. There are no psychiatrists. I mean, to get a psychiatrist, I've got colleagues that it's taken 9 months, 12 months to find one psychiatrist to serve their population. That's criminal. And further, and my last, is either pay now or you pay later. So we've got to look at paying up front and working with our kids and our families, the whole family together. We work with very complex situations. In the last 17 years, it has increased immensely, and it's putting a burden on our system of care. It's putting a burden on our providers. We all work together in Duval County. I love Duval County because we collaborate. Can you do this? No, I can't. Can you do it? Okay, let's figure out how to help this person. And with your support at our government level, we need to change things. And now,
thank you. Thank you. Next, we will hear from Jim DeBogren for Smart Justice Alliance, followed by Greg Frazier. 3 minutes, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will speak as fast as a country boy can possibly speak. I'm the Vice President of Spark Justice Alliance, and just to give you all an idea of what we do, we work with Tax Watch and many partners, our associations, to basically identify best practices, evidence-based approaches, and provide legislative advocacy to implement those. In a former life, I was a staff director of what is now, I believe, called the Justice Appropriations Subcommittee. And I was there during a time when we could not build prison beds fast enough. And unfortunately, what we were seeing is that a lot of that growth was being fueled by these year-to-day inmates, which in turn were being fueled by the burgeoning population in our local county jails. And I think it was very obvious to all of us that what we were seeing is that our jails and our prisons were very unfortunately becoming that safety net for people with severe, persistent mental illness. Also, in a previous life, I was the director of the State Agency for Persons with Disabilities. And so if there's one thing I can ask you all as policymakers to keep in mind, is many of the challenges, many of the frustrations, many of the tragedies, human and financial, to taxpayers, that apply for people with mental illness and substance abuse, we have those same issues with people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, with behaviors, people with autism, who oftentimes react just like someone with extreme paranoia. We have other people with low IQs who just have behavior issues or don't understand what's going on. And what I'd like to do, and I have a lot of facts and figures, but I think you've heard plenty of those. What I'd like to do is just to suggest to you maybe an analytical framework. After all, I was an analyst for 19 years. And what I would suggest is maybe you do this kind of like in a process mapping format. And I think if you do that and you plug in, you'll see there are certain threshold moments that lead to the kind of outcome I think that all of us are trying to figure out how to avoid. And I think what will also become apparent is some of the imbalances in the system that you've heard the other speakers mention rather emphatically. Obviously, if you do that, then you'll come to the inescapable conclusion that the very first part of this is to try to avoid unpleasant interaction between people with mental illness and law enforcement to begin with. And that requires a robust system of community-based mental health and substance abuse on the civil side before anybody ever comes in contact with a police officer. Then if there is, if that police officer does come in contact with a person with a mental illness, the training, the CIT in particular, that you will see that being proposed. And as Mr. Fontaine, who's no longer here, everybody wins if that person never gets that booking photo taken. Everybody wins if the situation would be de-escalated and the person never gets picked up and never goes to jail. And along with the training, I think maybe if there is a place, if there are resources in the community that law enforcement officer can take a person that he knows to have a mental illness and that he's really dealing with a person who is showing symptoms of mental illness rather than trying to commit a crime. Then you move further down that continuum, and I think these community reinvestment grants really can be used in very flexible ways in the community to get at these types of issues. And so we're fully supportive of the $9 billion that's being advocated for by our partners for the community reinvestment grant. So once they get in front of the judge, is the judge going to have the kinds of options? And are we going to at least have a framework with the necessary flexibility for these judges to basically, and I would suggest that you give serious consideration to codifying the mental health court. Again, only establishing broad guidelines so that each community tailor makes the specifics based on their strengths and weaknesses. Finally, if worse comes to worse and that person winds up in jail and prisons, you just have an obligation at that point to make sure that they get the adequate treatment while they are in jail or prison. Quite frankly, what you're going to find out, these are not therapeutic environments. That's why you don't ever want them to go there to begin with. And then I cannot emphasize enough, as other speakers have, and I'm going to close on this, that once they get out of the jail or the prison, $50, a bus ticket, a 30-day supply of meds, you just think about it. It's not going to be, I mean, that's just not in and of itself a recipe for success. Actually, a recipe for failure. There is a $2.5 million governor's budget rec for housing, getting at the issues, these ancillary issues that are probably just as important, if not more so, than the actual treatment itself. But it gets at the housing and it provides a place where people who have reached the end of their sentence can go have a place to live and ensure that they get what they need. And finally, and this is really aimed as much as at our state agencies and our provider network, data, data, data. That has been, and I also did the mental health measure. And I can tell you the biggest frustration I had back then, and I think it continues to be a frustration today, Mark mentioned it, is a lot of people collect a lot of data, but none of us ever see it. That detracts from the credibility of the system as a whole, and it makes it much, much more difficult to justify funding requests and to justify the types of investments that I personally believe is needed. With that, Madam Chair, I appreciate your indulgence. Thanks for having me here.
Thank you so much. All right, next we're going to hear from Greg Frazier, followed by Reggie Gaffney.
Okay. I'm Dr. Greg Frazier. I'm probably 2 and a half, good, if you start now. I'm Dr. Greg Frazier. I represent the National Board of Certified Counselors Foundation and the Five Star Veterans Center. NBCC Foundation was the other sponsor for the JCCI Mental Health Study. I have two fast recommendations that I would make. First would be take the systems in place that can work and should be working but are not working and make them work. Personal example for that, I have a very close relative who was released from the state correctional system who suffers from schizoaffective disorder and bipolar disorder. He was released without medications, without referrals. Had it not been for a family who was knowledgeable in the JRAD program that he had volunteered for, thank God, he would be back in prison. The fourth day after he got out, before we could get medications accessed for him, he looked at me and he said, "Is it just easier for me to go back in?" It's broken, but it can be fixed. That system should be able to work. Strengthen those systems that have been proven to work, such as JRAD. The SOAR program works. I was so frustrated with trying to find a SOAR caseworker in this city, which is not available. I took the training myself to find out why it was effective. Anybody who wants to know, see me after the meeting, I'll tell you. It's personalized. You are an advocate for the individual who is suffering from severe and persistent mental illness, and you are a face which this person will not have in being represented for SSI or SSDI applications. Otherwise, they'll have a voice on the phone. That'll be it. So that needs to be funded. An evidence-based program called the Mental Health Facilitator Program that can change some of the perceptions that cause stigma in our communities. It's a community-based grassroots program. I can send you some more information on that if you'd like to look at that. And finally and quickly, I was asked on behalf of my representation with Five Star Veterans Center to talk about veterans who have forensic involvement. Most often that forensic involvement is a result of the effects of PTSD and or traumatic brain injury which have remained untreated. The veteran will attempt self-medication and will get involved in the judicial system as a result of that. And one tremendous but poorly funded resource that we have in this city is the Veterans Treatment Court. They will intervene. It's a diversionary program. It gets these folks back on track. It really helps them. Success rate is extremely high. And they are partnering with the Five Star Veterans Center, who provides the housing for those who are experiencing homelessness at that time. And there will be an ask before the legislature this year. We've already had conversations with the budget about that. These are programs that are working, and these are the things that we need to do. We need to find those things that are already available, not waste any more time drawing maps or trying to decide what a big overall picture is going to be. We've been doing this for 10 years at least in this community. I was on these committees 10 years ago. So it's time for action. My final thought that I would like to leave you with is this. I had to write it down because I had to think this through. Private philanthropy is not the answer. There's not enough money out there. It's frequently a jump start, as we have seen with the generosity of Dolores and Wayne Weaver over the years. But when that money goes away, public funding has to pick up and support those jump-started programs that are working in our communities. Otherwise, if we continue to rely on personal private philanthropy, what we're going to see is what we've got. Thank you very much for the time.
Thank you. All right, members, we are down to 17 minutes, and I still have a number of speakers. We will hear as many of them as we can. Reggie Gaffney, to be followed by Dr. Teresa William.
Good afternoon. I'm Erica Goodman from Community Rehabilitation Center, speaking on behalf of Mr. Reginald Gaffney. Community Rehabilitation Center is a community-based organization where we provide services for people with severe and persistent illness. One of the things that we have had issues with is with the managed care, which was implemented on May the 1st of 2014, our entire industry has changed drastically. Clients are experiencing difficulties gaining and maintaining access to the
services at the community level, which has led to constant intake from states as well as increased involvement with our collection system. We have had multiple clients having difficulties with needing for our authorization to provide services that have been a long-term part of the client's treatment, and that has caused a disruption of the actual services. What we want to do is find ways that we can avoid issues with the treatment, the medication, as well as the transportation. We have also seen that some psychotropic medications now require prior authorizations despite the drug being a long-time part of the client's regimen, and trying to get these meds approved has been a battle that sometimes takes a slew of phone calls and days to get the responses needed. Long without medications can usually lead to a psychotic episode, which results in right and again, a constant inpatient stay or involvement with the correction system. Not enough community-based resources, funding sources have not increased, and just like what Dr. Candace Hodgman says previously, if we have a way to make sure that our ARNP subscribers have the ability to write scripts, it would also minimize some of the issues that we have with our clients not being able to see the psychiatrist. So in closing, if there is a way that we can minimize some of the issues and the battles and the blockages that we have experienced with our clients being able to receive authorizations and clearance for them to receive services and their medication, it will minimize some of the issues that we have seen with them being placed in a higher level of care, which also includes the correction system.
Thank you so much. And I see Lisa Brower getting her card out. And I know Lisa has been tremendously helpful to our office for the last 6 years. I want to thank you publicly for that. And if you guys can get together to try to solve these specific issues.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Next, we're going to hear from Dr. Teresa Rulian, and then followed by John Bowles and Derek Stevens. Thank you.
Good afternoon. Thank you so much for convening this workshop. And I'm busily over there cutting out pieces, so I hope that it still makes sense. But I do first want to say that not only am I here as President CEO of Child Guidance Center, but also a part of our Behavioral Health Network here in Northeast Florida, the Florida Council for Community Mental Health, the Jacksonville Kids Coalition, our United Way Agency Directors Association, been part of the JCCI Inquiry, the Health Strategy Council, as a provider with the Partnership for Child Health Initiative, and a provider with DCF working alongside LSF and our Family Support Services. And I share that information specifically because that is, as Candy said earlier, a part of what our culture here as providers has really become, and that is that we do work, and we do work hand-in-hand and shoulder-to-shoulder to really provide and seek out the services that our clients, our families, our constituents, your constituents need. So I guess you have heard that our messages are very similar, and I think that that is good. So I hope that you will continue to hear it from each voice that comes up here, because it does have a different take, but it still involves all the same. Being a member of all these organizations and working together, I think, demonstrates how the community system must work together, much as a family system must work. No one part can be easily or without consequences separated from the whole. And we are dealt as providers, as you have heard, that same dilemma daily as we attempt to navigate the funding world and the problems created in the siloing of these dollars. So again, I hope you have heard that and you hear that again, that that creates a major problem in service delivery to the community rather than to an issue. We need to serve the community, the people of our community. We always have trouble accessing dollars. I work with children, but my children have families, and the families are adults that often have substance abuse and mental health issues. So again, it connects, and I can't just take Johnny out of his family and serve him as if that's going to make a change. You've been provided the legislative priorities of the Florida Council. There are three of those. But again, please do not forget that ultimately, as has been said, true assistance for the criminal justice system, for the adult system, begins long before the first arrest. Prevention, early identification, and early intervention is a must. And it works, and we pay attention to it with physical help, But why do we not do the same with mental health? It's cost-effective to do it early rather than after the problem occurs. The first priority with the Florida Council is basically because of the past two decades of funding for community behavioral health systems, it has been ignored. And the reimbursement rates have not gone up or increased with any medical costs. The Council's research shows that Medicaid funding pays only 60% of the true cost of a mental health service. I have a spreadsheet which I can share with you later, which, for example, the Medicaid rate for psychiatric evaluation is $210, while the average cost to the provider is right at $315, and that's if you can find a psychiatrist. The reimbursement rate for individual therapy per unit, which is right 15 minutes, is $18, where the actual cost to me as the provider is right around $25. So you see, that just adds and adds. And attracting and retaining appropriately trained professionals is increasingly difficult because of that funding issue. Scientific evidence, obviously, is demonstrating that the right treatment, individuals with serious mental illnesses and addictions can and do recover. It works. They become employed. They graduate from high school and college. They live productive lives. However, an underfunded system creates significant gaps with these most vulnerable
settings. To ask you.
No problem. So I ask that you look over the Florida Council's priorities, and I really hope that, I look forward, I'll just assume in the positive, that we have our Behavioral Health Network, JCCI, forum next week, February 6th, and I really hope that you've all been invited. I hope you will attend and hear from other community members who have not been able to present today.
Thank you. Next, we'll hear from John Bowles of Barnabas, followed by Derek Stevens of Inside Telepsychiatry.
And I'll be real quick. I'm John Bowles. I'm the Health Services Manager of Barnabas up in Nassau County, which I hope to give a different little perspective because we've been talking a lot about Duval County. We haven't really talked about the other outlying counties. And especially in Nassau County, we have a lot of barriers, especially folks that work with problems with mental illness. At Barnabas, we are a very small clinic. We provide primary family practice care. We help with dental and things like that. And also with a strong partnership with Starting Point Behavioral Health, we're able to provide behavioral health counseling as well. The folks that we are seeing are at 200% or less of the poverty level, uninsured. Most of them are unemployed. Not necessarily homeless in the sense that they're living out in the woods, but they're homeless in the sense that they're doubled up with friends and relatives in a very rural part of the community. And so it's very difficult when these folks come in with these mental illnesses, and what do we do for them? And thank goodness we do have Starting Point, but there are so many other barriers, especially in a county like Nassau, which has a lot of rural areas. Transportation, we do not have public transportation in Nassau County. That is a major barrier to get anybody to any appointment. Also the extreme poverty that a lot of our folks live in. There is a lot of extreme poverty in Nassau County. Most people think of Fernandina, Amelia Island, but let me tell you, head out to Hilliard and Callahan and you'll see some extreme poverty out in that area. So it's a tale of two counties for us, and it's very difficult to get folks to appointments. And Jacksonville, which has a lot of resources, seems a million miles away to our Nassau County folks. So it's really difficult with the limited resources that we have and all in there. Thanks.
Thank you so much. Next we'll hear from Derek Stevens.
Thank you for having me the opportunity to speak. I'm Derek Stevens. I'm a licensed clinical social worker and an account executive for Insight Telepsychiatry. I work as a clinician in settings ranging from hospital, inpatient units, youth and foster care, and DJJ. Today I want to talk about the role of telepsychiatry to increase access to care. As I travel around my region, which includes several states, one of the big issues is just the access to psychiatry. So I've heard many people say it takes 9 months to find a psychiatrist. So usually when I'm talking to providers, they know they have the need, but the funding is not there, the reimbursement, the licensure issues, and it takes quite some time for a physician to be licensed here if you're not in state. So I think those are some things that definitely need to be addressed. Insight has been providing telepsychiatry since 1999. We do over 100 consults per year in settings such as correction, hospitals, outpatient. And I say that to say because we have quite extensive experience on how to kind of move through the spectrum of care, ranging from residential facilities and such. So I wanted to be brief on the factors that I think contribute from both clinician and barriers to for providers. So I think current laws and regulations surrounding licensure, reimbursement with Medicaid, in the handbook allows for telepsychiatry, but many of the MCOs don't cover it, so the providers can't utilize telepsychiatry. We have a shortage of providers, which increase wait time, and we have a lack of community resources. As a clinician, it is much cheaper and much more, I believe, effective to capture individuals in the community. You can work with families. When I worked in the inpatient unit, often my caseload was such that I worked to discharge a patient, but I rarely got a chance to sit down and educate and talk with families and follow up on community resources. Changes I see that need to be made, increase access to behavioral health clinicians. There is a shortage, and I think telepsychiatry and telemedicine is an avenue to enhance the availability of clinicians for patients. More emphasis on and access to preventative care, getting them before they go to the correctional facility or the ER, which is going to be much cheaper. Increased community resources. I heard that, I was in case management. The thing is, we can lay out all these things. I can schedule an appointment, but if the transportation is not there, if the prescription assistance is not there, if they're not community coordinators to make sure that all happens, we're just kind of spinning our wheels. What laws need to be changed, and this is kind of from a telemedicine standpoint, licensure requirements, reimbursement, mandating or working with insurance companies to provide reimbursement, Medicaid with the managed care plans, and the ability to prescribe controlled substances when appropriate in the outpatient setting. And so through telemedicine, you cannot. And then I'll just end with actually your comment. Mental health has a very personal and real effect on the lives of Floridians. I myself grew up in the foster care system, age 5 to 8. My mom had schizophrenia, drug addiction. My dad committed suicide. So I have a real kind of vested interest in this, and I definitely think we need to provide better and more efficient services for children and adults in the life. So thank you.
Thank you. Well, thank you, members, for coming today. Thank you to all of the participants. Thank you to the audience. I will apologize to those of you who signed up and asked to speak, but we simply have run out of time. I will offer that if you will send me your comments, I will promise to read them. And I've got business cards up here, so if anybody needs my email address, I want to hear from you. I'm working on a proposed bill for this next session, and I welcome your thoughts, your ideas on how we need to move forward to improve our community mental health system so that we can decrease the number of incarcerations of the mentally ill. I encourage each of you to come to me today with your thoughts and ideas. With that, Representative Brennan News be rise, and without objection, we stand adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you. Take care.